there. And we're doing all this to bring you the very best of UK comedy.
I moved in with my girlfriend this year. Thank you, yeah, it's going well. 2 days in, she asked me if I always breathe like that.
Live from the UK starts next Wednesday evening at 6:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 19th of February. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning. The headlines. Children who have special educational needs in England will have their legal right to support reassessed when they go into secondary school. That's been found out under leaked government proposals. And the family of a British couple detained in Iran say that they have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage, which they deny. We've managed to speak to one of the couple, Lindsay, from inside the notorious Evin prison in Iran.
We have so few tools at our disposal. We have no voice. We have no way of, all we can do is write letters and go on hunger strike.
And also in today's programme, the former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, joins us from a major summit on AI taking place in India. And a week of special programmes has been announced to mark Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday, including a behind-the-scenes of this special moment in 1979.
There is more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know.
We talked to the conservationist who introduced Sir David to the gorillas for his landmark series Life on Earth. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. They would lead to the system being completely redesigned, with implications for many of the 480,000 pupils who have legally binding education, health and care plans. Under the changes, children would have their plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school, something which could risk a political backlash. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
Many parents seek to get an education, health and care plan in place before the end of primary school for children with special educational needs. It confers legal rights to individual support. Under these reforms, the child would no longer automatically keep the EHCP as they go up to secondary school. Children with the most complex needs are more likely to retain an EHCP. But any cut in the number of those with legally binding plans will be hugely politically controversial. I understand to offset this, all children with special educational needs, including those currently without an EHCP, will get what's called an individual support plan. This will be assessed by the school and come with some legal status.
The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year while on a motorcycle trip around the world and are currently being held in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Craig and Lindsay Foreman were travelling through Iran on their motorcycles when they were arrested. They've now been held for more than 12 months, often in solitary confinement and incommunicado. At brief court hearings, most recently last October, the couple from East Sussex were accused of espionage, which they deny. The family say no evidence has been presented, nor any opportunity for defence given. They've now been informed the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Their son, Joe Bennett, said he was deeply concerned for their welfare. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said the sentence was completely appalling and totally unjustifiable and promised to pursue the case relentlessly.
President Trump has urged the Prime Minister not to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, saying the joint British-American military base may be needed to launch attacks on Iran. It's the latest shift in position by the American president, who said 2 weeks ago that the deal was the best Sakir could make. Here's our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth.
On Tuesday, the US State Department expressed its support for the Chagos deal, which would see the UK hand the islands to Mauritius and lease back a joint British-American military base on Diego Garcia for 99 years. But last night, President Trump wrote on social media that Sir Keir Starmer was making a big mistake, adding, "Do not give away Diego Garcia," in capital letters. In response, the Foreign Office said the deal to secure the military base on Diego Garcia was crucial to the security of the UK and its allies, and the only way to guarantee the long-term future of the base.
Tech platforms will have to remove intimate images which have been shared without consent within 48 hours under government proposals. Ministers say that those which fail to comply would face a fine of up to 10% of their global revenue or even having their services blocked in the UK. The Prime Minister told BBC Breakfast that these images should be treated with the same severity as terrorist material.
We need to pursue this with the same vigour as we pursue the images that go up or the messaging that goes up in relation to terrorism. But this is shockingly much more widespread than you might think in terms of the numbers of people affected by this.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is set to call for accountability for atrocities committed during Sudan's civil war at a UN Security Council meeting later. Britain has assumed the monthly presidency of the international body. The conflict between the Sudanese military and the Rapid Support Forces, which has lasted nearly 3 years, has caused mass displacement, widespread hunger and serious abuses against civilians. The founder of Microsoft, Bill Gates, has pulled out of attending the AI Impact Summit taking place this week in Delhi. Mr. Gates was due to deliver a keynote speech to an audience of tech bosses and world leaders later today. He has faced scrutiny over his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein after the release of emails written by the disgraced financier, which made claims about his personal life. The emails weren't sent, and Mr. Gates rejected the allegations as false. Our technology editor Zoe Kleiman reports from Delhi.
Bill Gates has pulled out of speaking at the summit with very little notice. He's already here in India this week and has been visiting tech hubs. In a statement on X, the Gates Foundation said the decision had been taken in order to make sure his speech did not distract from the focus of the summit. It did not mention Mr. Gates's association with Epstein. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has officially opened the high-profile global gathering this morning, but events have been taking place all week. Yesterday, one Indian university was told to pack up its stand and leave the summit's international AI exhibition after showcasing a robot dog which it claimed to have developed but was later revealed to have been made in China.
A letter, handwritten by the late Queen Elizabeth when she was between 10 and 12 years old and staying in Cornwall, is to be sold at auction next week. The note, illustrated with drawings of dogs and horses, is to the head housemaid at Royal Lodge in Windsor. It asks if the birds are well and the goldfish haven't died.
There you go. Jane, thank you very much. What a way to end a news bulletin. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's get the latest on the weather, shall we? Simon King's at the BBC Weather Centre for his morning, Simon.
Hello, Emma. Good morning. Yes, some of us waking up to a bit of a wintry start this morning. We've got some rain, sleet and snow out there. But for southwest, southeast and eastern areas of England, still a little bit cloudy. Some outbreaks of rain, particularly in the southwest. But that's all just easing off gradually. So this afternoon is looking much drier, although it will stay pretty cloudy for most. There be a few brighter skies developing in southwest England and maximum temperatures getting up to about 6 to 10 Celsius. For Wales, the Midlands and across northern England, this is where we've got this mixture of rain, sleet and snow. Now, most of the snow has been falling over higher ground, so there's been quite a few centimetres there, so there may be some travel disruption, for example, over the Trans-Pennine routes and some of the higher roads across Wales. But down to low levels, you may wake up to a bit of a slushy covering, maybe 1 or 2 centimetres, mostly on the grass and the rooftops, but otherwise not causing too many problems to low levels. There's a risk of some ice in places as well, but this rain, sleet and snow mixture is just going to fizzle away. So this afternoon is looking drier, albeit staying fairly cloudy. Temperatures getting to about 3 to 6 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, it's pretty overcast and pretty damp this morning. Some pockets of drizzle. We're going to see some rain spreading in from the west during the afternoon and highs of 6 to 8 Celsius. And across Scotland, well, some rain affecting northern and western Scotland today, but it is going to be drier further south and east across Scotland, although quite cloudy with overcast skies and top temperatures getting to about 3 to 6 degrees Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Mail and the Telegraph both reporting that retired heads of the Army and Navy, the former MI6 boss as well, have written an open letter claiming the Prime Minister is not being honest with the public over defence spending. The Telegraph says the signatories have warned that instead of receiving more money through Labour's planned increase in defence spending, the Ministry of Defence is facing cuts because of funding pressures such as pay rises for servicemen. The Mail says those who signed the letter have insisted the nation is unprepared for conflict with Russia, suggests that Britain faces a 1936 moment, a reference to the threat posed by Nazi Germany before the Second World War. A spokesman for the government tells the paper it is on track to meet the Prime Minister's target of spending 5% of GDP on defence and security by 2035.
President Trump's change of stance on Sir Keir Starmer's deal to hand the Chagos Islands back to Mauritius, or to Mauritius, I should say, is the main story for The Times and The Telegraph. The Times quotes the president's press secretary, who said that Mr. Trump's online post yesterday denouncing the move should be taken as the policy of the Trump administration, not the declaration of support, which came the day before. The Telegraph says it remains unclear whether the president's latest stance will lead to the cancellation of the deal, but recalls that ministers have previously said it couldn't go ahead without US support.
The Prime Minister's proposal to give tech firms 48 hours to remove revenge porn and deep fake nudes from the internet, or risk being fined or blocked in the UK, is the lead in The Guardian. The paper quotes Sir Keir Starmer as saying the burden of tackling abuse must no longer fall on victims, but on perpetrators and the companies that enable harm.
And The Sun reports, you might like this, Justin, that ministers have agreed pubs will be allowed to stay open until 1 or 2 in the morning during any home nations matches beyond the group stages. Oh, sorry, it's football, not rugby. Men's Football World Cup this summer. I was thinking, is that right? Forgive me. England and Scotland have already qualified for the tournament. Swig when you're winning, the paper's headline declares.
Yeah, there you go. 10 minutes past six is the time. Rishi Sunak's going to tell an AI conference in the Indian capital, Delhi, that AI has got to be a central responsibility of government. He's also going to paint quite an optimistic picture, but my goodness, the picture painted by some other AI bosses is anything but optimistic. Let's talk to Zoe Kleiman, the BBC's technology editor, who is in Delhi. There's some pretty dark stuff around, isn't there, Zoe, even if it isn't coming from Rishi Sunak?
It depends who you listen to, really. I mean, in some ways here in Delhi this week, it's big tech, big sell. All the giants are here and they've spared no expense. Google set up its own cricket nets to showcase an AI cricket training app that it's run. It's definitely the right country to do that in. Everyone I've spoken to so far here is cricket mad. I've also sat in on a discussion between Rishi Sunak and Alexander Wang, who's the chief AI officer of Meta. Now, he says they want everyone to have their own AI agent on their phone, which... he said, knows us all better than most people and runs our lives, our work, our relationships, our hobbies and so on. But of course, there's an awful lot of trust required, isn't there, before we take that leap. And you could argue that the tech companies don't exactly have that from consumers right now.
Yeah, and indeed from their bosses. So the boss of Anthropic, writing recently, some AI companies have shown a disturbing negligence towards the sexualization of children in today's models, which makes me doubt they'll show either the inclination or the ability to address autonomy risks in future models. I mean, he's also saying human civilization is going to find it difficult to impose any restraints on it at all.
So there are two ways of looking at this. Some people argue that this is a kind of attempt at regulatory capture, if you like. This is the tech company saying, you know, what we have here is so dangerous and so frightening that only we can be trusted to develop it safely, and therefore all the investment and all the power has to come to us. You are absolutely right that it's evolving very rapidly. It's the most rapidly evolving tech revolution, if you like, that the world has seen, and there are lots of concerns about the direction that it might go in. But there's also this massive sales push. There's talk about FOMO, fear of getting left out, countries not getting left behind. So there are two very opposing messages here in Delhi. But I think the one thing that we come back to time and time again, don't we? We've had three of these summits now. This is the fourth. We still have the tech throwing up the same challenges, the same problems. But there's absolutely no sign of anybody putting the brakes on it yet.
Yeah, OK. And we'll be hearing from Rishi Sunak directly at 20 past eight. Zoe Kleiman, thank you.
At 13 minutes past six, let's hear about an investigation by the BBC which has uncovered new evidence that vulnerable girls and young women in London are being groomed by gangs to carry drugs and have sex. Seema Kotecha is our senior UK correspondent. Seema, what's been found?
Yeah, so Emma, it's pretty grim, to be honest. My objective, just to kind of set it out, was to find out exactly what's happening in London. Are there grooming gangs operating here like there have been in other parts of the country, such as Rotherham, because that's where the focus has been in recent years. And from speaking to dozens of people over the last 8 weeks or so, and I'm talking about lawyers, survivors, police officers, charities, I've concluded that gangs similar to those in places like Rotherham, for example, do exist here. However, what I've also found is that there is a more complex style of grooming taking place in London, where young people who are vulnerable are being made to deal drugs and store weapons. And as part of that, they're also having to have sex with rival gang members, for example, or people their gang owes money to. We heard from the Metropolitan Police, and then they explained that the girls are at the bottom of the hierarchy when it comes to gangs. And they often have to do what they're told. And sometimes that does involve sexually. Now, this stems from what the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, said last year. He came under fire for saying that there were no reported cases or indication of grooming gangs in the capital, such as those seen in cities like Rotherham in South Yorkshire. And we know that those gangs were predominantly Pakistani men exploiting girls primarily for sex. But in response to my investigation, he has said that he wants to support the police to do everything possible to tackle all child sexual exploitation in the capital, including grooming gangs. And Emma, it's just worth saying that the government has said that its independent inquiry into grooming gangs will have full powers to compel evidence and hold local investigations. And the survivors that I've spoken to really do hope that London is a focal point.
Indeed. Seema Kotecha there, our senior UK correspondent. Thank you.
6:15 is the time. Does the UK need alternative payment options to Visa and MasterCard? It's something bank bosses are going to be meeting about today. Will has more on that. The rest of the business news from Salford. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Emma. Yes, according to the UK payment system regulator in a report it published last year, 95% of transactions with UK-issued cards are made using Visa and MasterCard, an issue that's exacerbated, of course, as we use cash less and less. The idea of an alternative payment system as a result has been in the works then for several years. But today the meeting will try to thrash out what shape a system funded by the city but backed by the government might look like. Someone who's done a lot of work around that is the former Nationwide chief executive Joe Garner, who's advised the government on this and whose own review in 2023 formed the basis of the National Payments Vision. And he joins us this morning. Joe, morning.
Good morning.
The rationale then, I suppose, first of all, for why look at this full stop?
Okay, so as you mentioned there, in 2023, the Chancellor asked me to lead a review for the government on the future of payments. The central conclusion of that was that the problem is that we had no vision for payments in the UK. So in 2024, a vision was developed, and that's expressed as a trusted world-leading payments ecosystem delivered on next-generation technology. And that's the key point, next-generation technology, because we're right in the middle of a transition to a new form that of money, whether we're talking about blockchain, crypto, stablecoins, central bank digital currencies, that exists and moves around in a different form. And so the purpose of the group and the meeting today is how do you take that vision for the next generation technology, trusted world-leading payments ecosystem, take that vision and turn it into a reality? That's what this is about.
I suppose one of the questions is why, though, isn't it? What is it that people are concerned about that isn't working right now that Visa and MasterCard are providing?
It's not really driven out of the card schemes. Let me try and frame what's going on. We are in a turning point for money itself. The first generation of money happened about 2,500 years ago when we started using gold and silver coins. The second generation was about 800 years ago when we started using paper, IOU notes and banknotes and so on. The third generation happened about 50 years ago with the first digital revolution. But all that really happened is that we put old-fashioned paper ledgers on spreadsheets in a bank. What's changing now is a re-tokenization of money. And what all those things I described, like blockchain, crypto, etc., they all exist in digital form in a token. And just to frame that, McKinsey just reported that you've got $250 billion of money flowing around, as one senior banker said to me, more and more non-bank money running over non-bank rails. And the payment systems of today work really well. Ask any consumer paying for their coffee in the morning. The UK's got a world-leading consumer experience today. But the very nature of money is is changing. And unless we build a new payments infrastructure that can interface with it, we could end up getting bypassed with this new generation of money.
European politicians, among others, have been those pointing to the potential for the US, because these are US companies, the main bedrock of this so far, could sort of cut off the payment system as well, and that is another rationale to move as well. European Union talking about a sort of Airbus for payments, sort of plumbing and things like that. Is that a rationale from your perspective as well, a reason to do this?
In my personal opinion, no. I think there's political speculation going on, but these are, they are political points. The relevant point to financial services is the following. We have in the UK the 2023 National Security Act, and that's relevant because as cash has declined, payments has become, in my view, critical national infrastructure. So we have a piece of legislation in the National Security Act that exists specifically to ensure that we're building and maintaining our national infrastructure in a way that is safe in terms of any kind of foreign interference, etc., from any direction. So we have a framework for assessing the safety and soundness of our payments infrastructure, and that's what we should rely on in making these decisions. And I'm sure that will be a consideration as the people get together today.
And presumably competitiveness around fees too. I'm looking at this piece from the payments regulator's report last year. Based on the evidence we gathered as part of this review, we estimate that UK businesses pay at least £170 million more annually for scheme and processing fees than they did 7 years ago. I'm guessing that would sort of try and address that concern.
So I looked at that when I was doing the review in 2023. We took input not just from banks, large and small, fintechs, but consumer associations, and importantly, merchants, the shops, hotels and businesses that pay the card fees. And yes, there's some frustration around card fees. But actually, when we looked at fees benchmarked around the world, the UK seems mid-table. The UK consumer gets about the best deal anywhere because we've got very high banked population, very high debit card usage, early and widespread adoption of contactless, and now with digital wallets, the UK consumer experience, I don't think it can get much better than it is today. A bit of optimization with contactless limits, etc. However, the big change has been as cash has declined, merchants have less of a choice. You know, in the past, they could take cash or take cards. Well, now they kind of take cards or take cards. So I think over the long term, it would be great for everybody, including the card schemes, if there was an alternative. However, to be clear, from a consumer standpoint, it's about as good as it gets in the UK today.
Joe, thanks so much for your time this morning. That's Joe Garner there, the former Nationwide chief executive who led that government review into payment systems. Well, Simon French is also with us this morning. Simon, the chief economist at Panmure Liberum. Simon, morning.
Good morning, Will.
You were on the programme at 7 o'clock yesterday, reacting very quickly to the inflation data when you and the team got to pick through it in a bit more detail. Anything you dug out that perhaps made your eyebrows raise? I don't know, something that was still persistently high in there?
The split between goods inflation, which is running at about 1.6% a year, and services inflation, which traditionally has been the more sticky, the more durable component at 4.3%, is a bit of a challenge because the Bank of England has to try and make monetary policy to hit its inflation target consistent with where it thinks inflation will be in 18 months, 2 years time. And therefore, having that stubbornly high services inflation and the degree to which that will come down as a combination of some of the more recent cost pressures ease, but also emerging slack, particularly in the labour market, which we heard about earlier in the week, start to bear down on price setting. It's a really bifurcated picture in terms of the inflation basket, and that's probably one of the reasons why the last Monetary Policy Committee meeting, the committee was split 5-4 on the next path for monetary policy.
Right, so it still kind of makes that decision slightly muddy.
Absolutely. And while financial markets, as I think I mentioned yesterday, are pricing an 80 to 85% chance of an interest rate cut next month, I think what happens thereafter is not just muddied by the inflation picture in services and goods, but also potential political changes in the UK that are being widely speculated around May, around the local elections, and where that changes the fiscal policy, the tax and spending backdrop that the Bank of England need to capture within their forecasts and their outlook.
Well, to that, what did the data do to borrowing costs, government borrowing costs and bonds yesterday?
again, gilts, the cost of government borrowing here in the UK, rallied, so yields went lower. And this is a trend actually throughout the week, particularly at the short-dated borrowing, which is more sensitive to expectations for where the Bank of England will move next. So again, pricing in a couple of interest rate cuts this year, starting to suggest it might even be a little bit more if the economy is very weak. But I think there's so much water to pass under the bridge, both politically and in terms of economic data, that I don't think anybody's making conviction bets in the second half of the year.
And the Telegraph reporting this morning that the Chancellor might do as little as possible in the spring statement from a markets perspective. Would that be welcomed?
It would be hugely welcome. I think the fact that the media, the markets really haven't spoken in any great depth about the upcoming spring forecast, which is less than 2 weeks away, is a really good bit of news. I think the feedback we got from businesses, from investors throughout 2025 was there were just too many events, two very big events where business investment consumption stopped because of fiscal uncertainty. If we just get one of those this year in November and March, we pass through slowly, that would be quite welcome.
Simon, thanks so much for your time this morning. Simon French, the Chief Economist at Panmure Liberum. Now, we were talking about this on the programme yesterday, weren't we? The Warner Brothers takeover saga at another juncture now. 7 days Paramount Skydance had from yesterday to make its best and final offer. But how is all of this being digested by the creative industry, those who get those end products from the big studios? Claire Binns is with us. Claire's the creative director at Picture House Entertainment, and she's also set to receive a BAFTA this weekend for outstanding contribution to UK cinema. Claire, morning, and congratulations on that as well.
Thank you very much.
What is the industry making of all of this here? We heard from Tim Richards of View Cinemas a couple of weeks ago on the programme, pretty worried about if it was a Netflix deal, what it would mean for the pipeline of films. Is that something you share?
I think I'm worried about the pipeline full stop, because Warner's released about 13 films in the last 12 months. Paramount, the same. Netflix, of course, had a lot of films that are Wardies films. What I'm concerned about is that we'll end up getting less films, whether we get them via Netflix or whether we get them via Paramount Warners. That is my main concern. And the concern is that we're going to have big packages rather than bold, exciting films, the kind of films that are released and audiences want to see.
And could that have an impact down the track, I don't know, for jobs in kind of production and things here in the UK as well?
Yes, of course. That is, I think, more the fear. What I would like to see is more films with medium budgets, so that we're getting more films made, but films that are not these giant, huge, you know, the Avatars, which cost trillions of dollars. And frankly, yes, they're great to have those tent poles. We all want those. But we also want a lot of films like The Wuthering Heights, like Sinners, like One Battle After Another, which are more mid-range.
Is that potentially something then that if and when it comes to it, the regulator here should look at, if any, whoever wins out in this deal?
Well, I, you know, clearly that's what I would like to see. But at the end of the day, I just think the concern is more that there will be less for people to buy tickets for.
Yeah, and the impact that could have on the cinema industry.
Yes,
Claire, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. Enjoy the ceremony this weekend. Claire Binns, Creative Director at Picture House Entertainment.
Well, thank you. 27 minutes past six to the sport. Here's Delith.
Morning, Justin. Arsenal blew the chance to move 7 points clear at the top of the Premier League after conceding an injury-time equaliser at bottom club Wolves. Mikel Arteta's side sit 5 points clear of second-place Manchester City. City, though, have a game in hand. Bukayo Saka says they dropped their standards big time. Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says they didn't deserve to win and they've only got themselves to blame.
Almost everything went wrong. We didn't have any control. We gave the ball away time after time. It didn't have any periods really of dominance, even though we scored the second half. Very disappointed, very frustrated. You can sense that. So now is not the moment to talk, because we are all too sensitive about it and you're not going to get anything positive out of that.
Anthony Gordon scored 4 first-half goals as Newcastle United thumped Karabag by 6-1 in Azerbaijan to take control of their last 16 Champions League playoff tie. The second leg at home is next week. Gordon, though, still wasn't happy.
I want more goals. I should have had more goals tonight, actually. Should have scored 6. I missed 2 really
Not easy chances, but chances I should score and normally would score. So good to get four, but I should have had more, I think.
Elsewhere in the Champions League, Bodo Glimt, the Norwegian side who pulled off a shock win against Manchester City last month, beat last year's finalists Inter Milan 3-1 in the Arctic Circle. Atletico Madrid drew 3-3 at Club Brugge, while Bayer Leverkusen claimed a 2-0 victory at Olympiacos. Nottingham Forest and Celtic are in Europa League playoff action tonight. The Scottish cup holders Aberdeen beat Motherwell 2-0 to book their place in the quarterfinals. There were three red cards in the game. Championship strugglers Leicester City have appointed former player Gary Rowett as their new manager until the end of this season. Arsenal eased into the quarterfinals of the Women's Champions League to set up a tie with rivals Chelsea with a 3-1 second leg playoff win over OH Leuven. It finished 7-1 on aggregate. At the Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina, Team GB's women's and men's curling teams remain in with a chance of qualifying for the semi-finals. The women's team beat both USA and Japan yesterday, while the men's rink sealed a 9-2 victory over the USA. And Ukrainian officials will boycott next month's Winter Paralympics after Russian and Belarusian athletes were invited to compete under their national flags. On Tuesday, it was announced 6 Russian and 4 Belarusian athletes will compete in alpine skiing, cross-country skiing and snowboarding at the Milan Cortina Games, which start on the 6th of March.
Dana, thank you for that. And now there is a new voice on Radio 4's Late Night Wednesday comedy slot.
Hey, I'm Slim. When I was at school, my report card said,
"He's clever, but not applying himself."
Little did my teachers know, this kid from South London would go from driving a bus in Brixton to becoming the first black British comedian to sell out the London Palladium. So when my daughter asked me about my life,
you know, what was it like?
I realised I've had a hell of a ride. So I'm going to tell my story through every decade from where I feel at home. On the comedy stage.
Yeah, man.
Slim's Guide to Life. Next Wednesday evening at 11 on Radio 4. We'll hear the whole series now on BBC Sounds.
Time is 6:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Justin Wehrman. Jane Steele with the news.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. They would lead to the system being completely redesigned, with implications for many of the 480,000 pupils who have legally binding education, health and care plans. Under the changes, children would have their plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school, something which could risk a political backlash. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year while on a motorcycle trip around the world and are currently being held in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. President Trump has urged the Prime Minister not to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, saying the joint British-American military base may be needed to launch attacks on Iran. It's the latest shift in position by the American president, who said 2 weeks ago that the deal was the best Sakir could make. Tech platforms will have to remove intimate images which have been shared without consent within 48 hours under government proposals. Ministers say that those firms which fail to comply would face a fine of up to 10% of their global revenue or even having their services blocked in the UK. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper is set to call for accountability for atrocities committed during Sudan's civil war at a UN Security Council meeting later. Britain has assumed the monthly presidency of the international body. The conflict between the Sudanese military and the rapid support forces, which has lasted nearly 3 years, has caused mass displacement, widespread hunger and serious abuses against civilians.
Jane, thank you. It's 28 minutes to seven. Leaked details suggest special educational needs support, as you've been hearing in the news, is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation, provoking a potential political backlash should it go ahead. Branwyn Jeffries is the BBC education editor. Branwyn, what's been discovered?
Well, what I know is that we now can see a glimpse of the key pillars of these radical reforms. Firstly, education, health and care plans. Those are the plans that give a child their individual legal right to the support that's set out in them. instead of staying with the child, those will be reassessed as they move through each stage. So from primary to secondary, there would be a reassessment, and potentially also from secondary into college. And it is not a given that the child would keep the EHCP. Alongside that, the government is going to propose an extension of a wider set of rights, which will cover the far bigger number of all children who have special educational needs, including those who currently don't have a plan, with an individual support plan. Now, that will be school assessed and school led, with a focus on outcomes, on actually what the results should be for the child in terms of helping them, not just of what the support is going in. There will be some legal rights attached to that, and it's not clear exactly what the status of that will be. So the fear from campaigners is likely to be a watering down of what they are familiar with a smaller number getting the current plans, whilst at the same time not yet being completely sure what these new individual support plans represent. And there will be three levels of support: targeted, targeted plus, and at the most complex needs level, specialists, where a national panel of experts will set out what could be expected for children with particular and often multiple levels of need at the same time. But this is a huge shake-up.
It is major. I mean, the government has said it's happened because of a very large consultation. There are those who've said for some time, for a variety of reasons, that the system needed shaking up, it needed changing. But there are also those who will be having an eye on the budget and how much this has cost and how much it was keeping this bill was growing. Is any of this likely to be welcomed?
So I think there is widespread recognition that the current system is pretty much broken for families because of delays, legal costs and an attritional fight to get the support they need. Schools say it is not working for them at the moment, and local authorities have recently been promised that the huge debts that they have built up because of a funding shortfall will be largely paid off. But there are big unanswered questions. How is the government going to fund this? What will it mean for school budgets? Once funding is taken into central government in a few years' time, the Office for Budget Responsibility has identified a potential £6 billion gap unless there is major change, because this is a system which at the moment is seeing exponential growth in costs. And at the same time, there has not been a commensurate improvement of outcomes for children with special educational needs.
Branwen, we're going to look into this with more detail, and I'm sure there'll be also a lot of passion and feelings raised around it if these details are as they seem, which they are at the moment. Branwen Jeffries, our BBC's education editor, will be coming back to this just after 8 o'clock. Thank you.
24 minutes to 7. The Chagos Islands have once again exploded in the government's face, courtesy of a social media post late last night from Donald Trump, saying the deal the UK government wanted to do to hand the archipelago to Mauritius, then lease back the military base at Diego Garcia, is a big mistake. Joe Pike's up, a little correspondent, which they weren't saying before. I mean, to what extent does the government think that there is now a settled position and this is it?
Well, the government think there is a settled position. They are unsure what they think the US's settled position is now. This did come as a complete surprise, Justin, to a UK diplomat. Number 10 sources telling me it wasn't part of the Trump-Starmer call on Tuesday evening. Tricky for the Foreign Secretary. She was about to head in to chair the UN Security Council in New York when that Truth Social post popped up. Yes, a surprise, but not, as you've sort of intimated, Justin, a shock, considering the array of views on this that the president has displayed in recent weeks. He gave it his blessing a couple of weeks ago, said it was the best deal the PM could have got, also previously said it was an act of great stupidity. I think we have seen in recent weeks a sign of a slight fracturing in the UK-US relationship, or at least some rare public disagreement. in particular the PM's interventions a couple of times on the US approach to Greenland. Other factors, perhaps some raising the idea that the possibility of airstrikes on Iran may make the value, the importance, the significance of Diego Garcia towards the front of President Trump's mind. One source involved in the campaign against this deal has said Trump is concerned Keir Starmer is trying to do a trade deal with China and Chagos is a bargaining chip. Others pointing to what they characterise as the generally deteriorating UK-US relationship. Also, finally, Justin, the PM's future too. One person telling me, why would they offer Keir Starmer a lifeline by giving political support to this deal when he could be gone tomorrow? Although, of course, we know that there could be a limit to the president's future too, because after the midterms in November, the race to be his successor will start.
So what does the government do?
Well, from messages I've had with people in government this morning, there is no sign they want to change their position. Their line is the agreement we have reached is the only way to guarantee the long-term future of the base. The saving grace, though, perhaps UK diplomats are hoping, is the complete inconsistency in the US administration approach. And the State Department, of course, backed the deal a couple of days ago. One source saying the UK government side ran all of this through the State Department, and that gave them a false sense of confidence. But we heard very clearly what the press secretary to the president said last night. She said, look at the Truth Social post. It's coming straight from the horse's mouth. We've also got this absolutely bizarre situation where foreign policy, which is usually an issue where UK politicians unite, especially the two big parties. I mean, that is not the case here. We've had two campaigns on two different sides. Some British politicians trying to sell it, some to kill it. Conservatives and Reform this morning both trying to claim credit for perhaps killing it, if that is what happens in the long term. Ian Duncan-Smith, the ex-Tory leader, has confirmed to me he's been in Washington. Lord Kempsall, a former Boris Johnson aide, has been involved. And also Nigel Farage, too. He's pretty delighted. We knew he had good relationships with some in Trump world, but he has, his allies say, built up good relations with the MAGA wing of the Republican Party for a long time. He points out that he hasn't just been campaigning on this for a few days. I've been trying for a long time. Finally, what next, Justin? I think it's unclear for now when that legislation is back in the Lords, but the government could have a few rocky days ahead. One phrase used by someone close to the PM last night was, strap in.
Yeah, and there's an added complication. We're going to hear at 20 past seven from the former London bus driver who now calls himself the interim first minister of the Chagossian government and is actually sitting there on a beach talking to us. Joe, thank you.
I look forward to that. It's 20 to seven. Last January, Craig and Lindsay Foreman were on an around-the-world motorbike trip when they were arrested inside Iran. A month later, they were charged with espionage and the couple have been imprisoned ever since. They're in their 50s, they're from East Sussex, and they've appeared in court several times during last year, but have been waiting to hear what would happen next from the Iranian authorities. You're actually going to be able to hear from Lindsay a bit later on in the programme, who Anna, our colleague, managed to interview from inside the notorious Evin prison. But Lindsay and Craig have always denied the charges. And actually, since that interview, things have moved and things haven't moved for a long time. They've just been told their sentence, 10 years imprisonment. James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent, is here. James, morning.
Good morning.
How do we compare this to Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe in the sense of, you know, innocent people being used as political pawns?
Well, and the key factual difference here is that these are two British nationals. They're not dual nationals, which is a complication because Iran does not recognise the concept of dual nationals. So Craig and Lindsay Foreman are, you know, they are Britons. They were on a global tour, as you say, and on their motorcycles. They were just planning to spend 5 days in Iran travelling through. They had a visa, they say. They had guides. And then on the penultimate day of their trip, they were then picked up and they were then detained, subsequently flown north to Tehran because they were in the south. And as you say, are now being held in Evin prison. But to a certain extent, what is similar to the Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe case is that they are being held by a regime that is feeling vulnerable, that has a long track record of taking political prisoners as hostages, that they are then used politically as pawns. And in the geopolitical context that we're in at the moment, with a huge US armada off the shores of Iran, with a regime that has recently lost substantial power because of its weakening proxies in the region, and the Israeli and American attacks last year means that any foreign nationals, and there are others, are being held by a regime that feels particularly vulnerable at the moment, that will be clutching onto whatever tools they feel they've got.
And just in terms of, you know, how this may play out, 10 years imprisonment, what the British government can do, what do we know of that, just briefly?
Well, Yvette Cooper has put out a statement, the Foreign Secretary, saying the sentence is completely appalling and totally unjustifiable. She says, we will pursue this case relentlessly with the Iranian government until they see the couple safely returned. The problem with this is that, as we've seen in previous cases, there's very much a limit to what the British government can do. Relations between the UK and Iran are poor. They see the UK as very close to the Americans. So there is a limit. I suppose the one slightly less pessimistic point is that during the protests last month, the British embassy had to be closed and its staff withdrawn. That embassy has now reopened. But even with that, consular access to British nationals by British diplomats is hugely difficult and problematic. Although Yvette Cooper says that that they will do everything, the welfare of this couple is a priority, and they will continue to provide consular assistance to them and their families, on the ground, that is quite limited.
James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent, thank you. We'll come back to this story shortly.
16 minutes to 7 is the time.
The task of rebuilding Gaza will be discussed at the first meeting of Donald Trump's Board of Peace in Washington later today. The group set up by President Trump to oversee his peace plan for Gaza was, and widely criticised, I should say, for not including any Palestinians, is facing the challenge of disarming Hamas and planning Gaza's reconstruction. Since the US-imposed ceasefire began in October, Gaza's health ministry, run by Hamas, says more than 600 people have been killed in Israeli strikes, and Israel's army has accused Hamas of launching daily attacks on its forces. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson reports from Jerusalem on the growing signs that Hamas is regaining control.
4 months into the ceasefire in Gaza, Hamas is rebuilding its rule. Police now patrol streets, direct traffic, and check regulations with stallholders in Gaza City. Some here say crime has dropped. Many others are too afraid to speak. During the war, gangs were stealing from houses and we were afraid to move around, said Ahmed Abdulrahman. People would stay inside their homes after sunset. Now there's security. The extension of Hamas control has raised questions about whether the group will be willing to give up its weapons and authority as required under the second stage of Donald Trump's peace plan. Mohamed Diab, an activist in Gaza, has been monitoring the changes.
Hamas has regained 90% control in the areas where it is present. Citizens must go to the Hamas authorities for identity cards or health procedures. And it's also reasserting control over the judiciary and courts.
One trader, speaking to us anonymously, confirmed that ministry officials now had to be present when cargo was opened. He said taxes were negotiated, starting at $6,500 per truck, and that force was used against those who refused to pay. A Hamas spokesman told us that in Gaza's exceptional situation, administrators sometimes needed to act firmly with traders who didn't meet their obligations. Even the smallest makeshift market stalls are reporting visits from bureaucrats now, even as their own homes and shops lie crushed under the rubble. Every day the municipality comes, said one man selling cigarettes in Gaza City. Let them count the stock and the sales, cigarette by cigarette, and tell me, should I pay them or feed my children?
Every single day they come to us aggressively, with the same demands and the same determination, saying if we don't pay, they will throw us and our goods into the street. They're asking for 700 shekels. None of us can afford that.
Israel's army sees the focus on revenue as a sign that Hamas wants to rebuild its war machine. saying its forces are still trying to attack Israeli soldiers on a daily basis.
Well, Hamas looks at the ceasefire as a time to regroup, to fight against us. This is why it's crucial for the agreement to disarm Hamas completely.
Lieutenant Colonel Nadav Shoshani is a spokesman for the Israeli military.
A lot of people listening to this are going to be saying, the IDF, the Israeli army, has been fighting Hamas, hammering Hamas for 2 years. Didn't work.
Well, I think we've achieved a lot of the goals of the war. But this war is not done until Hamas is not disarmed. And if Hamas doesn't disarm, there's different solutions for that.
What happens if they don't?
Hamas needs to disarm.
What happens if they don't?
That is the first sentence of the agreement. We expect that to happen. If not, there's a lot of tools on the table to make sure it does happen.
Disarmament is seen as a thorny issue for Hamas, ideologically committed to fighting Israel and facing threats from rival groups at home. But Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said the group was ready to implement Donald Trump's peace plan.
I believe we can find a reasonable approach to the issue of weapons that removes any pretext for renewed war and is also compatible with President Trump's plan. There will be a comprehensive, transparent handover to the new National Committee for Gaza once it arrives.
Trump has so far kept his plan on track by relentlessly pushing it forward past hiccups, disputes and delays. The spotlight today will be on the first meeting of his Board of Peace. But behind the scenes, the battle for control of Gaza isn't over.
Lucy Williamson reporting.
And that brings us to 11 minutes to 7.
The star witness, Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder and Meta chief, took to the stand in front of a jury, first time he's been in front of a jury, in a Californian court yesterday. This landmark legal case asks whether his company, as well as Google's with YouTube and the like, has deliberately built products to be as addictive to children as possible. But how did he do when taking the stand? Earlier I spoke to Sonia Sharp, legal affairs reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
I was frankly a little surprised. He was pretty combative on the stand, which was really not necessarily what I expected. Yeah. We sometimes see different versions of Mark Zuckerberg when he's been asked to testify before Congress, for example, or when he gives his keynotes, launches new products. He was correcting the attorneys a lot. He was showing kind of real open frustration at times. Several of us said, we felt he was being quite pedantic at moments about kind of small differences that I think you or I or a juror might find fine grained, I guess.
In terms of what he said, as well as how he came across, did we learn anything in terms of his defense of Meta, his understanding of how parents are concerned?
I wouldn't say that he had a lot to say about his understanding of parents' concerns or of users' concerns, for that matter. A lot of what was happening on the stand, frankly, is that the plaintiff's attorney was seeking to bring evidence, like records that they had obtained through discovery, into the public record so they could be part of the evidence that the jury considers. And then he would ask Mark Zuckerberg about certain things, like, for example, what does it mean in this 2022 document when you say you have a milestone of we want users to be on the app for 40 minutes a day? Is that a goal that you have and how are you achieving it? And then there was a lot of back and forth about what's the difference between a milestone and a goal. But I think most people in the room and probably most jurors would understand that if the company has put in writing that they want to see these escalating numbers of how many minutes a day each of us is using Instagram, that's a goal, right? That's an objective that they have. And so there was a lot of back and forth about what does it mean? You know, what does it mean when you're talking about users under 13 and, you know, how we target them or don't target them? That was a lot of the back and forth. And Zuckerberg was very emphatic that he wants to create something that everybody will love and everybody will enjoy using. And the plaintiff's attorney was much more interested in trying to draw out, why do you want that? And what does that mean? And where's the dollars and cents?
Was he asked about if he was media trained or how he was coming across?
Yes, that was a wonderful little exchange in there. You got pressed on, you know, what kind of training have you had? And they showed some things that I think were meant to maybe rattle or embarrass him about he's supposed to come across as human and empathetic and, you know, like he's listening. And he made this kind of funny aside to the jurors. He says, I think I'm actually sort of well known to be very bad at this, which is kind of our first laugh line of the day.
Well, it's a kind of awareness, but also acknowledging what you're saying without acknowledging it, isn't it?
Right. And this even came up in voir dire, right? They were really had to sort out jurors who had a particularly negative view of him. And that was one of the things when I talked to experts about this case, is there was a lot of attention on this day, not only because this is a celebrity and this is a very powerful, very wealthy person, but also because how's it going to turn the case to have someone like this who typically does tend to rub people the wrong way and has a reputation for that kind of behavior and
do you
vibe?
Think, yeah. Do you think he did rub them the wrong way? I mean, do you think he has turned the case in his favor or against? Is there a way of saying that at this stage?
I think it's too soon to say, and everyone will warn you against reading jurors too closely. I will say this. I was told by experts, and I had kind of thought this as well. This case, the defense really wants older men, and the plaintiffs really want women, especially young and middle-aged women, on the jury. And one of the jurors today was excused because I guess he's in the hospital, he's in poor health, and he was an older man and he was replaced by a middle-aged woman. So I think that might have hurt them as much or more as anything that Zuckerberg said, but I certainly didn't think that they came around to him, if that makes sense. I don't think he did anybody any favors today.
Thank you so much, Sonia Sharp, their legal affairs reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Mehta told the BBC that it strongly disagrees with these allegations, and it is confidence the evidence, as they say, it will show our long-standing commitment to supporting young people.
7 minutes to seven. Not everyone at the AI Jamboree, the global summit involving the bosses of the companies and many governments as well, that starts today in Delhi, is positive about even the business case for AI. There are plenty of fears about what the technology might do to jobs and to our way of life, but at least we're often told there will be a boost to wealth. Let's talk to Professor Cecilia Recap, who is Associate Professor in Economics and Head of Research at the UCL's Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose, and joins us on the line now from Delhi. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Jesse. I'm actually from home, but I am following the AI.
Well, you're as good as in Delhi then. look, tell us this first of all. We hear again and again the case for AI that focuses on the enormous benefits to productivity that there could be and the wealth that will be unlocked by it. To what extent should we be questioning that case?
So, extraordinary question, because actually, in the best case scenario, this is an exaggerated promise. There are studies, even one by Adaro Masemoglu, who won the 2024 Economics Nobel Prize, who clearly explains that in the next 10 years, in the best case scenario, there will be maximum, even less than 1% gain from AI in economic terms. So 1%, not per year, 1% in the 10 years combined. So why? Why is it? And even the studies that perhaps say that there is an economic gain, one needs to really read the studies to realize that they're only looking at the micro level. They are only looking at the companies that will win with AI, such as a call center. They are not looking at the global macro effect, which basically means that if you're replacing workers, if the affecting part of the economy is massive layoffs, these workers will need to work somewhere else. And think very easily of the example of the gig economy. The gig economy, an Uber driver, that is not, the number of Uber drivers is not determined by demand. So someone without a job can easily go to their phone, download the app and start working. And that decreases the productivity in the gig economy because you have more workers for the same number of rights. So the more people is laid off from some parts of the economy because AI is replacing them, the more these people will go to the less productive sector of the economy. So globally speaking, there will be no economic gain.
I mean,
at least you need to put them into question.
I can now see why you're not in Delhi, because that's not at all the message, is it, you get from the big companies?
No, absolutely not. The other way around. Why? Because precisely they are trying to sell more of this technology, not only to automate labor, but also to control workers. And this is the other reason why it's not getting the economic gains expected, because to control your workers, you need to spend more money. So the question really here is also, even, let's say I'm exaggerating, let's say that there will be substantive economic gains. Who will get them? Because certainly this will not be in the UK economy. This will be US big tech, Chinese big tech. This these will be the leading companies in the world that have already been capturing society's data, society's research, because these companies, part of their advantage is based on research that was done here in the UK, and not only by the companies that were acquired, let's say DeepMind acquired by Google, but also by universities like Oxford, Cambridge. And then there is also who pays the costs. When we speak about economic gains, we also need to think about costs. And here, the UK is another example, because we are receiving more and more data centers from these companies, which do not create jobs. The only jobs that they create are construction jobs. Once the data center is functioning, it's only 50 jobs per building, and they do create a massive ecological footprint. So again, who's going to benefit? And then in the end, it's not about whether we want AI or not. It's about what type of AI, for whom, for what, who decides.
Okay, well,
and
look,
this is what is being decided in the summit.
We're going to have to leave it there, but you have given us food for thought, and we're going to be talking to Rishi Sunak, former Prime Minister, at 20 past eight, and we will put some of those fascinating things to him. Professor Cecilia Rickapp from UCL, thank you.
Before the anthems, before worldwide fame, before becoming a frontman, he was a drummer.
Really had no ambition to be a singer. I really didn't want to come out from behind the drums.
It's Eras, Phil Collins.
I'm Zoe Ball, and this is a story about an accidental icon.
If that divorce thing had never happened, I would never have started singing and writing in the way that I did, which means that Phil Collins' solo guy would never have happened.
It's the latest series of the Radio 2 podcast, Eras. Listen now on BBC Sounds. Just search Phil Collins.
Weather time, Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Some of us waking up to a wintry start across Wales, the Midlands and northern parts of England. We've had some snow overnight. Most of that has been over higher ground, but even down to some lower levels, you may just see a slushy 1 or 2 centimetres of snow on the ground this morning. The rain, sleet and snow mixture is all going to ease away. So for much of England and Wales into this afternoon, it's looking drier, although staying fairly overcast. There will be a few brighter skies developing across Wales and southwest England, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 4 to 10 degrees Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, pretty overcast this morning, a bit of drizzle around. We'll see more substantial rain spreading in from the west during this afternoon. So a spell of rain here and highs of 6 to 8 degrees. And across Scotland, well, for northwest Scotland, it's going to be pretty overcast with some outbreaks of rain through today. But further south and east, it's going to stay largely dry, although quite cloudy, and highs of 3 to 6 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 19th of February. The headlines. Children with special educational needs in England will have their legal right to support reassessed when they go into secondary school. That's emerged under leaked proposals, which could trigger a political backlash. A British couple who were arrested in Iran more than a year ago have now been sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage, which they deny. We'll get the reaction from their son, who's been fighting their case from the UK from home at 7:30. And before the sentence came in, we also managed to speak to one of the couple, Lindsay, from within the notorious Evin prison inside Iran.
I came here as part of a global initiative to focus on the good, to focus on finding unity and humanity. And that hasn't changed. In fact, if anything, my desire to find what connects us is even greater.
Lindsay Foreman there. And President Trump has shifted his position on our government, on the UK government's Chagos Islands deal, calling it a big mistake.
And also in this hour, another Chagos complication. Some Chagossians have returned to the island in an attempt to stop the British transfer of it to Mauritius, or of them to Mauritius. We will be hearing from one of them.
They're going to have to drag me from my beach. They could even have to kill me. They're going to have to kill me on my island. Because exile that happened half a century ago can't be happening right now, 2026.
And is the former London bus driver who now styles himself the interim first minister of the Chagossian government. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. They would lead to the system being completely redesigned, with implications for many of the 480,000 pupils who have legally binding education, health and care plans. Under the changes, children would have their plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school, something which could risk a political backlash. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
Many parents seek to get an education, health and care plan in place before the end of primary school for children with special educational needs. It confers legal rights to individual support. Under these reforms, the child would no longer automatically keep the EHCP as they go up to secondary school. Children with the most complex needs are more likely to retain an EHCP. But any cut in the number of those with legally binding plans will be hugely politically controversial. I understand to offset this, all children with special educational needs, including those currently without an EHCP, will get what's called an individual support plan. This will be assessed by the school and come with some legal status. Ministers are likely to argue this will lead to more support at an earlier stage, without families needing to battle with the system.
The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year while on a motorcycle trip around the world and are currently being held in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Craig and Lindsay Foreman were travelling through Iran on their motorcycles when they were arrested. They've now been held for more than 12 months, often in solitary confinement and incommunicado. At brief court hearings, most recently last October, the couple from East Sussex were accused of espionage, which they deny. The family say no evidence has been presented, nor any opportunity for defence given. They've now been informed the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Their son, Joe Bennett, said he was deeply concerned for their welfare. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said the sentence was completely appalling and totally unjustifiable and promised to pursue the case relentlessly.
President Trump has urged the Prime Minister not to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, saying the joint British-American military base may be needed to launch attacks on Iran. A year ago, Mr. Trump told Sakir that he was inclined to go along with the UK's agreement, before branding it an act of great stupidity last month. Then 2 weeks ago, the US president said the deal was the best Sakir could make. In his post last night, the US president condemned the plan and insisted the UK should remain strong in the face of wokeism. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth reports.
On Tuesday, the US State Department expressed its support for the Chagos deal, which would see the UK hand the islands to Mauritius and lease back a joint British-American military base on Diego Garcia for 99 years. But last night, President Trump wrote on social media that Sakir Starmer was making a big mistake, adding, "Do not give away Diego Garcia," in capital letters. It's not clear what prompted the latest shift in position. It's understood the matter wasn't raised in a phone call between Mr. Trump and Sakir on Tuesday night. In response, the Foreign Office said the deal to secure the military base on Diego Garcia was crucial to the security of the UK and its allies, and the only way to guarantee the long-term future of the base.
Tech platforms will have to remove intimate images which have been shared without consent within 48 hours under government proposals. Ministers say that those which fail to comply would face a fine of up to 10% of their global revenue or even having their services blocked in the UK. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Revenge porn is the sharing of intimate images without a person's consent. That is already illegal. Now, the government wants to compel social media companies to remove such pictures and videos within 48 hours once they've been reported. The plans also mean that victims would only have to flag an image once, rather than contacting different platforms separately and waiting for them to respond individually. The Prime Minister told BBC Breakfast the images should be treated with the same severity as terrorist material.
A UN fact-finding mission says evidence of atrocities during the siege and takeover of the city of Al-Fasha in western Sudan points to genocide. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces captured the city in October after an 18-month blockade, one of the most brutal episodes of Sudan's nearly three-year civil war. More details from our Africa correspondent Barbara Plettacher.
This is the closest the UN has come to declaring that genocide is being carried out by RSF fighters in Darfur in the current conflict. The fact-finding mission said the ethnic targeting of the population in Al-Fashir was so systematic and brutal that it bore some of the hallmarks of genocide. That included deliberate efforts to physically destroy a targeted population through mass killings, sexual violence, starvation and destruction. In this case, members of non-Arab African tribes, particularly those defending the city from the Arab militias of the RSF. RSF leaders have previously admitted some violations occurred, but said the extent of the atrocities was exaggerated. The report said they did not respond to investigators' questions. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said she would take the conclusions of the report to the UN Security Council today. She said there must be accountability for the perpetrators, justice for the victims, and an end to the arms flow from outside powers feeding the conflict.
In the past few minutes, the former president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has been found guilty of insurrection and given a life sentence after he attempted to impose martial law in 2024. The politician's declaration triggered street protests and was abandoned. Mr. Yoon was later impeached and removed from office. A new study published in the medical journal The Lancet estimates that more than 75,000 people were killed in the first 15 months of the war in Gaza, some 25,000 more than the Hamas-run health ministry previously reported, and more than its current total. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
During the Gaza war, Israel has repeatedly questioned the number of Palestinians killed given by the Hamas-run health ministry. But this new research suggests a substantial undercount in the official figure. The study involved an economist, demographer, epidemiologist and polling experts and was based on a survey of 2,000 families in Gaza. The researchers say that by the start of January 2025, 15 months into the war, the official number for violent deaths was more than a third below their estimate. The research also found that reporting by the Hamas-run ministry about the proportion of women, children and elderly people among those killed was broadly accurate.
Official figures on the number of children living in poverty in the UK are expected to be revised down because of concerns they haven't been accurately reflecting household income. The BBC has been told child poverty levels are likely to be lower than stated in the official statistics going back to 2018. Experts have identified a unique fossil found off the coast of Northumberland, which has been described on social media as the smiling rock or alien face. It's now been revealed to be a crinoid, a distant relative to the starfish that dwelled in the UK's shallow waters 350 million years ago. It was discovered by Christine Clark on a Boxing Day trip to the holy island of Lindisfarne.
I just saw this thing looking up at me. I was like, what on earth is that? It looks like a set of false teeth. So I picked it up and it looks like a jaw's head. So I just put it in my pocket. And then when I got to my husband, I said, oh, look, by the way, look. And he went, oh, my goodness me. It looks weird. It's like an alien, little alien head. I said, I know.
Christine Clark speaking there.
Thank you. 7:10 is the time. We were hearing in the news that the details of what the government is proposing for the future of SEN, special educational need education, has been leaked. At the moment, the SEN designation comes, of course, with legal rights to support, but often those rights aren't really borne out in reality. Plenty of parents know that all too well. It seems now that there may be a cut in the numbers with the legally binding right, but a new structure to go alongside it. Let us talk to Gary Auburn, who's on the line, Director of SEND for Whole Education, a member of the Curriculum and Assessment Review as well, and indeed author of The Parent's Guide to SEND. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Your thoughts?
So firstly, there's a lot we don't know yet. So as with all these things, when we get things leaked in bits, it's waiting to see the full detail. I think it's true that there are children and young people being let down by the fact that our system is totally overwhelmed and broken. And there are also staff in schools, colleges and early year settings being equally let down by the fact that they don't have the training, support, resource, time, infrastructure to be able to meet needs really well. At the same time, there are also, staff in schools, colleges, earlier settings deserve to be recognised as doing absolutely wonderful, committed, expert work with children with SEND every day at the same time as that.
What seems to be the plan, just trying to kind of boil it down to the essence, is that if a child has the most complex needs, they pretty much stay in the system as it is, that they get the full legal rights. If, though, they don't have those needs, there's going to be some different way of dealing with them, which comes from the school itself. What do you think parents will make of that?
I think that there's such a lack of trust in our system that anything that further erodes that is very tricky indeed. I think the EHCP system is overwhelmed, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong one. The issue I see with the EHCPs at the moment, and there are double the amount of children and young people who have one as we had about 8 months.
This is an education, health and care plan.
Yeah, so for pupils with a higher level of need, and there are more children, young people in our system with a higher level of need, and that should be absolutely, that should be celebrated in our schools, the increased need, increase the desire of mainstream schools to make it right for their local communities. But one issue with EHCPs is that what you want is SENCOs, therapists, educational psychologists and others spending a lot of their time serving children and young people and serving the staff who are working with them every day to help them to make the best decisions they can in classrooms for children. And actually what our system has at the moment is many of these people lost in quite bureaucratic or argumentative processes that don't serve families well, don't serve children well, and therefore EHCP is absolutely remaining as a vital part of our system. But if you can change EHCP so that more children have their needs met earlier by schools being able to make the best decisions with resource for the children in front of them at an earlier point. That, I think, if these changes mean that, then I'm hopeful for.
The other thing that seems to be in the offing is that EHCPs become, you don't automatically keep it, basically, as you go from primary into secondary school. There is some sort of reassessment, compulsory reassessment at that stage. What do you think parents will make of that?
Well, I think needs do change over time. So we need a system, of course. And we do have one, but the amount of EHCPs that get ceased in reality is very low. So needs do change, and we need a system that reflects them. My concern about what's been shared today about timings is at the end of key stage, particularly that move from primary school to secondary school, is such an anxiety-inducing one for families, having been through it myself. You know that when that child gets from year 6 to year 7, if there's any threat of support being reduced, that's going to make that whole process worse for everyone. And we already know the national data around that year 6 to year 7 transition point has all kinds, you know, it's really fraught with worry. So what we I don't understand why it wouldn't be better to go, actually, the child's going to transition from one key stage to the next, for example, do one full year of secondary school. And that's the sort of, you know, big point at which we ask questions. Mm. Are we confident the child's transitioned well, and therefore a reduction in support is not about cost cutting? It's about going that child is more can be more successfully independent than they used to be able to be, and let's celebrate that, and let's also change the support that child needs.
Gary Orban, co-author of The Parent's Guide to SEND, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past seven. A UN body has found evidence of atrocities carried out during the siege and takeover of the Sudanese city of El Fasher, which points to genocide. This is the closest that the UN has come to declaring genocide is being carried out in Sudan. Mona Rishmawi is member of the UN Independent International Fact-Finding Mission for the Sudan, and she is one of the three experts of the report, and she's based in Geneva. Mona, good morning. Welcome to the programme. What has the report found?
The most disturbing part, thank you for having me first. The most disturbing part is that we found three aspects, three elements that are characteristics of genocide to have taken place in and around El Fasher. So we are talking about mass killings. We are talking about inflicting conditions of life through 18 months of siege. We are talking about rampant sexual violence of incredible cruelty. And all this basically was targeting two specific ethnic groups, particularly the Zaghawas and the Fur in Darfur. So when we looked at the evidence altogether, we could only conclude, the only conclusion that we could reach is that it meant genocide. That's the only reasonable conclusion that we found. So it is a very, very disturbing, actually, finding, and it points directly to genocide.
What do you want to happen next? What will happen next?
I mean, the issue about with Sudan is that the main issue is the protection of civilians. The war has now moved to Kordofan. It's really important that this modus operandi that is genocidal does not continue to be repeated. It has been repeated time and time again. So protection of civilians is really important, and I'm very pleased that the Security Council is looking today at Sudan, and hopefully they can think of practical measures. There are a lot of issues before them, so that's really important. The second is definitely accountability. The perpetrators are doing this, and the leadership of the rapid support forces are doing this because they think they can get away with it. So we need very strong messages, very strong action that they cannot get away with it.
Mona Rishmawi, member of the UN Independent International Fact-Finding Mission for the Sudan there. Thank you.
17 minutes past seven. Tech companies have seen their share prices plunge in recent months amid constant speculation about the capabilities of AI. But one UK company has been going the other direction, and Will has more.
I do indeed. We've got the boss with us, in fact, Justin. Yes, this is Cambridge-based Raspberry Pi, manufactures credit card-sized computers and has seen its value increase by more than 50% this week, at one point re-hitting a valuation of more than £1 billion. And Eben Upton, the company's chief executive, as I say, is with us. Eben, morning.
Good morning.
And this is all kind of around, really, your company's kind of ability to allow AI to run off the cloud, to run kind of locally. Is that right?
That's right. People have been using Raspberry Pi computers to run a piece of AI agent software called OpenClaw. So I guess you could see it as a rebalancing of AI innovation away from the core of the network, away from these enormous data centers that people are building at the moment, towards devices that you can have in your home.
Right. And so is that why, to sort of follow on to from how Justin kind of set it up there as well, is that why the interest? Because it's not got the kind of associated gigantic spend around things like the sort of data center build out that you would need if you're doing it via cloud.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, we have a couple of customer bases at Raspberry Pi. We have a large industrial customer base, and we have a smaller but very active enthusiast base. And it's this enthusiast base, hobbyists, technologists in their homes who've been using Raspberry Pi in this way.
Yeah, so kind of almost democratizing some of the AI when there's been kind of concerns about it only being in the hands of the very biggest, the very richest.
That's right.
In terms of the share price's volatility, I mean, there has been some comparisons on there, the FT among them, saying it kind of has looked a little bit like a meme stock. People might remember that was sort of GameStop, the American company, in the past as well. Any concern about the kind of level of volatility and what it allows you to do?
I think what you're seeing here probably is some crossover between the sort of the very active enthusiast community around Raspberry Pi. And, you know, we have a significant retail. We have a significant retail component to our shareholder base. I think it's nice, actually. I think what it means is a lot of our retail shareholders, to the extent that they're also Raspberry Pi users, have a fairly sophisticated understanding of what the platform can do. They are some of our most sophisticated shareholders. And I think you're seeing some of that excitement come across from the technological side of the business to maybe the financial proposition.
And we had you on when you listed here in London as well. Has that then been a success? Has it been a validation, I guess, of that decision?
Yes, I think so. It's been interesting to watch the evolution of our shareholder base since the IPO in 2024. Certainly an increasing fraction of our shareholder base is retail. We were a little bit limited at the time of the IPO for regulatory reasons in terms of what proportion of the shareholding we could allocate to retail. And it's been good to see that grow over time.
Eben Upton, Chief Exec of Raspberry Pi. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. 20 past seven is the time. First, Donald Trump pulls the plug on his support for the government's plan to hand the Chagos archipelago to Mauritius, then lease back the military base at Diego Garcia. Then, a former London bus driver turns up in the archipelago and claims to be the interim first minister of the Chagossian government. Misli Mandarin is his name. His family were removed from the Chagos Islands by the British when the military base was built. He has never been and does not want to be Mauritian. From the islands, he's been telling me how he's been managing since he arrived there.
My family been living on Chagos Island for many centuries. So my dad, he know where to get fish, he know where to get breadfruit, and we bring some supplies with us as well. We bought in Thailand and Sri Lanka as well. So the most important is not about the food. The most important is the legality of it. Because I'm a Chagosian, my dad was born on Chagos Island and was exiled on Chagos Island, but we don't want that to repeat itself again. That is the most important thing we're doing now.
What the British government says is that this is an illegal, unsafe stunt.
What happened yesterday, we got a patrol boat came and serviced a removal notice. It's very hypocritical for the British government to say it's unsafe. For more than 50 years, many native Chagossian die in abject poverty, die in exile. So for now, we took the risk. We took the risk. The four people, the four Chagossian, for the entire Chagossian population. We're perfectly happy what we have done. We came in our homeland and we said that we have to stay British because we are British citizens.
What will you do if the British say to you, we are going to arrest you and take you off the islands?
They're going to have to drag me from my beach. They could even have to kill me. They're going to have to kill me on my island. Because exile that happened half a century ago can't be happening right now, 2026. And the world is watching.
What the British government wants to do is to lease back Diego Garcia from the Mauritians and hand over control to Mauritius. Why is that not acceptable to you?
There's no reason to do so because Mauritius never owned Chagos Island in the first place. The only reason this kind of madness is happening because before 1968, before Mauritius became an independent country, Mauritius was part of Britain, was part of British colony as well. So it seems to me, and which is very, very insulting to the Chagossian people, why this British government go and make this deal without consulting the Chagossian and try to repair the colonization of Britain. We don't care about this. We are British and we are happy. So my daughter was born in Manchester. My daughter was not born in Portlaoise. So I'm looking for the future generation. Many, many Chagossian children are born in United Kingdom.
Now President Trump has weighed in and said the deal is stupid and he opposes it. Do you think that's going to make the difference for you, that that is going to change the British government's mind?
The sad things about it, Justin, why we need to have a foreign leader to come and help British Chagossian. Keir Starmer have to see clearly that deal doesn't work for Britain, doesn't work for the US, doesn't work for global security.
What do you say to Keir Starmer this morning?
I'll say, Keir Starmer, as my Prime Minister, you have to look at this treaty again. British Chagossian on this island, yesterday you sent patrol to give us removal or notice. The island belonged to us. Harold Wilson did that in late 60s, early 70s, removing the Chagossian from their homeland. And that is a stain on British politics. But now it's 2026, Keir Starmer. You could be a hero right now. Don't ratify that deal. Cancel that deal and let the Chagossian come back to their homeland as British.
Miss Lee Mandarin, thank you very much for talking to us.
At 25 minutes past seven, Delith Lloyd's got to follow that with the sport.
Hello, Emma. Mikel Arteta admitted almost everything went wrong as Arsenal blew the chance to move 7 points clear at the top of the Premier League. They conceded an injury time equaliser to draw 2-2 at bottom club Wolves. Anthony Gordon scored 4 first half goals as Newcastle thumped Karabag 6-1 in the first leg of their last 16 Champions League playoff tie. Holders Aberdeen beat Motherwell 2-0 to book their place in the Scottish Cup quarterfinals. In the Women's Champions League, defending champions Arsenal beat OH Leuven 3-1, 7-1 on aggregate. They face Chelsea next, while Manchester United take a 3-0 lead into the second leg of their playoff against Atletico Madrid this evening. I've been speaking to the former England and United goalkeeper Siobhan Chamberlain this morning, who told me the Gunners looked comfortable in the end.
They made it a little bit tricky in the first half of the game, let the team back into it, Leuven. But they did the job really last week, didn't they, in the away leg, got the goals and made it a lot more comfortable. I think when it's chucking it down with rain, it's blowing a gale, the pitch is cutting up, it's not the perfect conditions for an important Champions League game. But as you said, got the job done through to the next round.
And it sets it up nicely, a quarter final with Chelsea next.
It does. And from my perspective, it's a real shame. I'd love to see the kind of the English teams get further and not have to knock one another out. Obviously, Arsenal and Chelsea, two real top teams. And it's a shame that only one of them can get further. I'd like to see them maybe meet closer to that final if they could get there. But a great opportunity for an English team to get further. So we know we're definitely going to see at least one English team into that semi-final. So fingers crossed, it's a great matchup, and we get some entertainment.
Absolutely. And Manchester United, of course, 3-0 up against Atletico Madrid in their knockout playoff game, the home leg tonight. They seem to be making a statement, don't they, Siobhan, United this season, in what is, of course, their first season in the Champions League proper?
They really do. They've kind of just quietly gone about their business. I think the new league format of the initial section of the Champions League allows people to just kind of get the job done. You don't have to do anything too spectacular, but you can qualify for the next phase. And they've done that. They've got good results. They've had a couple of not so good results, but they've managed to get themselves through. And the performance against Atletico last week was brilliant. Away from home, to score 3 goals, to keep a clean sheet and be able to bring that back to Manchester today, looking pretty comfortable, if I'm honest. Like, I don't want to jinx anything, obviously, but I can't see Atletico coming back from that with the performance that the team put on last week away from home. Now, with their home supporters, obviously, the 3 goals, Atletico have got to come out at them now. They've got to open up, and United can exploit that.
And Bayern Munich await in the quarterfinals, but United, they're on an 11-game unbeaten streak. I mean, the season is shaping up nicely for them, isn't it? They're second in the WSL, they're in the League Cup final, still in the FA Cup. What will they realistically be hoping to achieve, Siobhan, this season?
Look, they'll want to go as far as they can in every competition. Whether you can do that in them all straight away is going to be really tricky. We've seen that even with Chelsea. The Champions League's been that elusive trophy for them. But they'll want to win something for sure to get as far as they have done in as many competitions as they have, and then come away with nothing will be incredibly frustrating. So they'll want to win some kind of silverware. Obviously, everyone wants to win the Champions League. I think this season it could be one step too far, but to get to the quarterfinals, to put up a good showing against Bayern Munich, potentially get even further, I think that would be fantastic for them.
Former Manchester United and England goalkeeper Siobhan Chamberlain there. Finally, at the Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina, Team GB's women's and men's curling teams remaining with a chance of qualifying for the semi-finals.
Thank you very much for that, Della. Starting on Radio 4 next week, a new UK-wide comedy showcase.
Are you ready for your next act?
I'm Angela Barnes, and I've been back on the road searching high and low for the most exciting stand-up comedy acts out there, stopping in Belfast, Edinburgh, Brighton, Liverpool and Swansea, all to showcase the incredible comedy the UK has to offer.
I once made a TV show with the German youth bobsled team, right? So the four of us got into the four-man bob and they knew what they were doing, so they were tucked in. I was like a dog looking out a car window, right?
Live from the UK starts next Wednesday evening at 6:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And just have a look at the weather. Today, southern areas will see any rain and snow ease through the morning, leaving a mostly dry and dull day. Largely cloudy in the north, patchy rain moves into the northwest later in the day.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. The time is just a tad before 7:30. In fact, it is now 7:30. Jane still has the news.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. They would lead to the system being completely redesigned, with implications for many of the 480,000 pupils who have legally binding education, health and care plans. Under the changes, children would have their plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school, something which could risk a political backlash. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year while on a motorcycle trip around the world. President Trump has urged the Prime Minister not to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, saying the joint British-American military base may be needed to launch attacks on Iran. It's the latest shift in position by the American president, who said 2 weeks ago that the deal was the best Sir Keir could make. A UN fact-finding mission says evidence of atrocities during the siege and takeover of the city of Al-Fasha in western Sudan points to genocide. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces captured the city in October after an 18-month blockade. The former president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has been found guilty of insurrection and given a life sentence after he attempted to impose martial law in 2024. The politician's declaration triggered street protests and was abandoned. Mr. Yoon was later impeached and removed from office. Official figures on the number of children living in poverty in the UK are expected to be revised down because of concerns they haven't been accurately reflecting household income. The BBC has been told child poverty levels are likely to be lower than stated in the official statistics going back to 2018.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 28 minutes to 8. Last January, Craig and Lindsay Foreman were on an around-the-world motorbike trip when they were arrested inside Iran. A month later, they were charged with espionage, and the couple have been imprisoned ever since. They're in their 50s, from East Sussex, and they've appeared in court several times last year and have been waiting to hear what would happen next from the Iranian authorities. Lindsay and Craig have always denied the charges, but they've now been told their sentence. 10 years imprisonment. Yesterday, before news of the sentencing had been released, Anna Foster managed to interview Lindsay via telephone from the notorious Evin prison where she's being held. It's quite an extraordinary ability to have that conversation. The couple had just sent a letter to the Iranian authorities complaining about their treatment so far.
It's a roller coaster, and there's a pre-me this situation. I've been sort of trying to work out what I feel, and so shock is what I would have felt, but now I'm not shocked by anything that happens here. The physical reaction was, I suppose what I would be used to is, you know, the pit of my stomach and my mouth went dry and just disbelief, really. But then I'm surrounded by people who are in, you know, worse situations, who've had to live this their entire life. So in some way I feel lucky that, A, I've had the life I've had up until this point, and hopefully one day for me it will end and I will come out of this situation a wiser person.
What effect is this having, Lindsay, on your physical health and on your mental health as well?
Well, physically I've been doing yoga since solitary confinement, so it has been my absolute saviour, probably physically and mentally. I was running around in circles, trying to do 5K. I'm passionate about parkrun, love doing 5K runs, and was attempting to maintain that, but it's incredibly difficult in a very small yard, I think. And I suppose, resigned myself to the fact that my physical health might not be what it was before I came in, but that I can regain it when I leave. And mentally, it is like an endurance test for the mind. It is incredibly hard to remain positive, but thankfully I have a lot of tools at my disposal, which I use every day.
این تماس از زندان اوین و تماس گیرنده زندانی می باشد.
It is a one day at a time situation.
While you were talking there, Lindsay, we heard a recorded message in Persian that played over part of what you were saying. We heard most of it, but just to let you know that's what we just heard briefly at our end. Tell me, Lindsay, about the letter that you are writing to the Iranian authorities.
So it is a desperate attempt to try and bring justice into this situation. We have done what we can to be respectful of their system, to be patient with the legal process, believing that our innocence will prevail. But it doesn't seem to be the case. We wanted to respect their very strong belief that they don't want foreign interference and not refer to international law or human rights law. I've read their constitution, and so I have referred only to their own internal Islamic Republic constitutional law in an attempt to say, even in your own system, your own judicial system, you're in violation of the laws. To try and do anything to help us get out of this situation.
Are you planning to go on hunger strike?
Again, you know, we have so few tools at our disposal. We have no voice. We have no way of, all we can do is write letters and go on hunger strike. That is pretty much all we can do to, I use the word protest lightly because obviously here it has a very different meaning. But we need to exercise our right.
این تماس از زندان اوین و تماس گیرنده زندانی می باشد.
to be heard both by their legal system to say, you know, what you're doing is unfair and unjust, and, you know, we are prepared to suffer ourselves to make that understood.
The fact that we're having this conversation, Lindsay, you and I, suggests that the backing, the support that you're getting from the British government is not what you would expect and not what you need, because they should be sorting this out for you.
Yeah, and it's difficult to know what to expect. And I take, you know, I put my hand up, I take responsibility for being here. We did check the government website before arrival, but we also tried to communicate with the government to say, how does one get round the world when you have what I call the messy middle, the bit that there isn't an easy way through or round or over? How do we navigate this? And looking at, you know, the Iranian information that is available, and they say guests are God's companions. You know, the Iranians are the warmest people you'll meet. And so it was that version of the truth I wanted to understand. And it is true. They are the warmest people, except they're, you know, living in circumstances that don't allow them to do that to the full extent. So, you know, perhaps the reason I'm here is to help with that.
Lindsay, we've only got a few moments left, so take this moment to speak directly to the British government, directly to the Iranian leadership. Say what you'd like to say.
I came here as part of a global initiative to focus on the good, to focus on finding unity in humanity, and that hasn't changed. In fact, if anything, my desire to find what connects us is even greater. I do not want conflict between our government or any governments. I think as a nation, I'm proud of what we do. I think we can find and must find ways for us to be connected in a way that is fair and just. That's all I ask for, is fairness and justice. And yeah, I hope that moving forward from this, we can prevent this from happening to anyone else in the future.
That was Lindsay Foreman talking to Anna Foster there. And in the audio, as Anna referred to in that recording, you can hear a message sporadically being played down the phone line in Farsi saying that the call is coming from Evin Prison, just in case you didn't hear Anna's explanation. You were wondering why there was that interruption on the line. Earlier, I spoke to Joe Bennett, the son of Lindsay Foreman. He's organising a campaign to get them home, and I asked for a reaction to the sentencing.
It was gut-wrenching to hear. You know, it's devastating. A 10-year sentence is a shocking sentence, but almost in a strange kind of way, we now know what we're facing. And, you know, once you know what you're facing, you can begin to fight it. I do believe that the government, the whole way along this process, have said that, you know, we've got to wait for sentencing. And now that that's there, I do feel that, you know, they can step up to the mark, and they should step up to the mark.
You're kind of out of one part of purgatory and have a bit more clarity, certainly, about something definitive happening, because obviously they've been detained in prison now for just over a year. When did you find out about the sentence?
We had it confirmed yesterday. It filtered through on Tuesday, late Tuesday night, but again, we didn't have any confirmation of that until yesterday. Spoke to the Foreign Office, spoke to Hamish Falconer, and, you know, even Yvette Cooper's now come out and changed their tone. So, as I say, it's a very strange thing to have to live through, especially for my mum and Craig. It took them quite by shock.
If you don't mind sharing, what was her response, what was Craig's response to the 10-year imprisonment?
I mean, it's tough, isn't it, right? Because you don't fully ever know. But I think if you look at history, the 10 years is just a number, and that we work towards it being as short a time as possible. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's an absolutely mental thing to be discussing with your innocent mother and stepfather that they are facing 10 years in an Iranian prison. I think if you look at the playbook, which there isn't much of one, but if you look at it and how it plays out from sentencing, we have seen some cases that are resolved within a matter of weeks. Mm. We've seen some cases that unfortunately drag out for years. There's no set tone for this. But as I say, what we have to hope is that this is a step in a direction.
I mean, I'm very familiar, as many of our listeners will be, with what happened to Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe. And she was held for 6 years in total. How much of a concern is that? And I know you've also been in contact with Richard Ratcliffe, her husband, and Nazanin.
It's a concern. You have to take different accounts from, I think, not just the UK, but from around the world. I suppose, again, have the reality of that this can go on for years. And that's a very tough conversation to have with your mum and, you know, your stepdads. But also we've got to hope that lessons have been learnt from these previous experiences. As I say, we're very raw off of this information, so I'm not expecting any substantive update from the government tomorrow, because they have to have their conversations with their counterparts.
But also, but the position of Iran and what's going to happen in terms of America and these attempts to get a deal, I mean, it's a very, very hot situation right now.
It is, absolutely. But I think, you know, one thing they've always said is that they want to keep... The way that this has been set up is that those talks, from what I understand, are very separate to any other talks that go on. So whilst that does take priority for the country and for the nation, that doesn't mean that the other things don't happen in the background. So,
well, one would hope, but it's, I suppose I'm just saying there's a backdrop to this, and there's a lot of discussion around regime change or altering, and the circumstances under which your mother and her partner have been, you know, imprisoned, are being sort of questioned on that much bigger scale. And I think, you know, when we got to understand a lot more about Nazanin's story, it was that understanding of how individuals are used in a much larger political game.
Well, that's exactly it. You don't know what they're trying or using the leverage for, right? So it may well be that they're trying to use this as part of the deal. You'd like to think that it's all part of a plan. I mean, nothing has given me notion that they have much of a plan. But again, I don't know how they operate fully. It's very difficult to understand whether or not this has been done in turn at a particular time that benefits the Iranian system in some way. But ultimately, that leads to release of my parents. You know, we have to, as I say, take what comes in the next week or so. And see how this looks to be playing out.
Joe, as ever, I wish it was under different circumstances, but good to talk to you and thank you for making the time.
No problem, thank you. And soon it will be under different circumstances, hopefully.
I hope so too. Joe Bennett there, the son of Lindsay Foreman, speaking on behalf of Lindsay and Craig. And the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has released this statement saying this sentence, the 10-year sentence we were just talking about, is completely appalling and totally unjustifiable. We will pursue this case relentlessly with the Iranian government until we see Craig and Lindsay Foreman safely returned to the UK and reunited with their family. In the meantime, their welfare is our priority and we will continue to provide consular assistance to them and their families.
Time is just coming up to 7:45. Here on Today, we are marking National Year of Reading. As you know, we're focused on getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. Some of the best-known authors reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. And this morning, it's the poet John Cooper Clarke, the so-called Bard of Salford, known for books including The Luckiest Guy Alive, I Want to Be Yours. He tells us about all kinds of printed matter, how all of them sparked his love of reading at an early age.
What ignited my love of reading? Well, I think it's a kind of bordering on a sickness with me. I mean, the moment I received the gift of literacy, I had to read everything. I think I mentioned in my memoir, my earliest days of literacy, and I would read any kind of printed matter that was put in front of me as a matter of course. And take checking out the ingredients of canned foods or processed foods in shops. People do that as a matter of course now, you know, what with the craze for wellness. And I've always had to read anything in list form, especially, as I say, inventories of accumulated paraphernalia, which I think this passage in Dino by Nick Tosius amplifies to a high degree. When business was slow, he stropped and swept, polished his mirrors and trim with metal glass, arranged the rows of his sundry embrocations and tonsorial balms, the opal and cobalt stand bottles of tonic waters and witch hazels, the amber jars of brilliantine, the long-neck jars of aqua di colonia for the sports, the Osage Rub and the Wild Root, Auerbach's Million Dollar Tonic and Fitch's Tonic Superb, the Lilac Vegetal and the Love Me Dearie, the Bald Pate and the Herpicide, the canisters of Mange Remedy and Talcum. Only then, when all these things were seen to, would he allow himself to sit. And then never in the great porcelain, steel and leathern cushion poltrona itself. No, that was reserved for those to whom he ministered. What we're talking about here is cadence, isn't it? And, you know, if you read any list aloud, you know, it turns into a poem, believe me. The more minute detail there is, the better. I've always tried to work some of that stuff into my poetry and to use the power of lists. The relentlessness of lists is always attractive to me anyway, and I hope I convey my enthusiasm to my thousands of enthusiasts.
John Cooper Clark there talking about how lists ignited his love of reading. He was reading from Dino by Nick Tosh, a biography of the singer Dean Martin. It was first published in the UK in 1992 by Secker and Warburg.
Now, at 13 minutes to 8, it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning, Dr. Rachel Mann, Archdeacon of Salford and Bolton.
Good morning, Emma. Few Christian ministers receive tributes not only from fellow faith leaders, but also from current and former presidents and members of the world's political elite. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, however, was no ordinary Baptist minister. He ran twice for US president, was relentless in his support for African-American civil rights and those of other minorities, and was hugely respected for his anti-apartheid work. He stood at the side of Martin Luther King, and of whom Barack and Michelle Obama said, "We stood on his shoulders." However, it was the tribute from Jackson's family that brought me up short. They said, "Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless and the overlooked." As someone who knew Jackson primarily through seeing him on 80s TV, I confess my first thought of him was as an extraordinary orator, not a servant leader. To speak of servant leadership is to draw deeply on the biblical tradition. Jesus shocks his disciples by saying that he came not to be served, but to serve. On the night before he died, he disturbs his closest friends when he insists on washing their feet, a role traditionally taken by the lowest of the low servant. This is not the kind of leadership the disciples expected or wanted. On close inspection, Jesse Jackson's track record as a servant leader is beyond question. He was first an activist, who I believe was unafraid of the unglamorous work of service, precisely because, as he said himself, "I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I had a shovel programmed for my hands." His job, as he saw it, was to use the gifts he'd been given to stand in solidarity with the lowly and to give them up, to lift them up rather than cast them down further. In 1989, Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King, said of Jackson, "He is the leader for the homeless, for the locked out, for those who have no hope." It would be absurd to pretend that Jesse Jackson was a flawless human being or the complete servant leader. However, the motor for both his actions and his words was a deep faith in the gospel of Jesus, the servant of the servants. Jesus himself said of those who would lead, "You will know them by their fruits." I think that by any measure, Jackson's record of service to those whom he described as the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised was fruitful. In my mind, I picture God now saying to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant."
That was Thought for the Day with Dr. Rachel Mann, Archdeacon of Salford and Bolton. It's 10 minutes to 8.
Reform UK have a man they say is ready to be Chancellor. If, of course, they are to be taken seriously by the financial markets and the voters at the next election, this role is pivotal. The man handed the job by Nigel Farage is Robert Jenrick, who held a variety of roles, of course, in Conservative governments in recent times, including cabinet roles. And Mr. Jenrick, the Reform UK Treasury spokesman, the Shadow Chancellor, as Nigel Farage calls him, is here in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And you are starting with a big spending commitment, which is a commitment to the triple lock for pensioners. So pensions going up at 2.5% or inflation or earnings, whichever is the highest. Why?
Well, actually, we said we're going to be talking about that in the coming days. We haven't made that commitment right now.
But you've made it clear that...
But what I have said, absolutely, is that I've always supported it because we care about providing older people with dignity in old age, and they're on fixed incomes. The cost of living is tough right now. People's bills keep going up and up and up, and we've got to make sure that people are supported during that period of their lives. But the same applies to people across the country right now. Everyone is feeling hard up, and the mission of reform is to be careful with people's money, to manage the public finances responsibly so we can bring people's bills and their taxes down and make life better for people who are struggling
that,
at the moment.
Do you accept that the triple lock will have to end?
Well, it's a big commitment. That is why we're taking this seriously and why, you know, you'll excuse me, I hesitate before making these commitments on the radio, because what I'm looking to do with reform is to instill great confidence in people that we're not going to make tax and spend commitments on the hoof. We're going to do things in a very deliberative manner so that people can have faith that when we say we're going to do something, it's fully costed.
So when I started by saying you were committed to it, what you're making plain this morning is you personally see its utility.
Nigel Farage, myself, we all see its importance, that we want to protect pensioners, but we're going to be saying more about it in the coming days.
And Nigel Farage, speaking yesterday, said it's open for debate. So my question, I suppose, to you, and it's a reasonable question from potential reform voters, is who decides? Is it you or him?
Well, Nigel is the leader, but, you know, any good CEO listens to their CFO, and we want to be a successful
team
together.
But when he says it's open for debate, in other words, that you might go into the next election not committed to it, or at least say there is a cut-off somewhere along the line, that seems to be...
I completely understand your line of questioning, but the point I'm making is you just going to wait a little bit longer. We're going to be saying something specifically about it. And I hope your readers will take heart from that, in the sense that what I want to ensure is that when you hear something from us on tax or spend, you will have faith that we thought it through very carefully, that it's fully costed, and if it involves a tax cut, that we found the fiscal headroom for that, and so it is sustainable, and people can trust us to manage their money carefully.
You would reimpose the two-child benefit cap. Why? Is that for financial reasons, or because you think it's morally the right thing to do?
It's both. Look, we all want to support families to have kids and to bring them up properly, particularly those on low incomes. And we're going to find ways of doing that through bringing back good jobs, through getting people's bills down. But at the moment, we simply can't afford to do so through more welfare. And so Nigel and I discussed this and concluded that a reform government would have to reinstate the cap in full.
Did you have some persuading to do there? Because previously he has thought, well, we should keep it.
Look, we did discuss it. That's clear. And we came to this conclusion together. The original reform policy was well-intentioned. Reform is a party that believes in family. It's one of our core missions. And we want to find policies that help Brits to have more kids and to look after them properly. But you just can't afford to do so when the public finances are in the state that they are at the moment through more benefits. The benefits bill, as we can all see, is going up and up and up. Keir Starmer and Rachel Rees themselves just a few months ago were saying that it's not financially sustainable to do this, but because of their weakness, they've had to give in to their backbenchers and reverse their
previous
position.
But I wonder if Nigel Farage has had to give in to you, because in a sense, maybe this is the next step for reform. So he's been very much a one-man band, as he says himself, and he wants it to be something else. So I suppose it's a reasonable question to ask you. You've come in to reform from the Conservatives. You've got firm ideas about what should happen. And on this, on the reimposition of the two-child benefit cap, you have persuaded him, which is something different for reform, isn't it?
You know, we did have a conversation, and I have persuaded him to take this view. And look, reform is trusted by the public on immigration, on crime, on integration, on restoring pride in our country. There are some people who have made the argument, I think very unfairly, that, you know, reform might want to increase benefits or does not, as a newer party, have the same track record on the economy. Although look what's happened under the Conservatives and Labour in the way they managed
the economy.
Well,
it's a political thing, isn't it? Because quite a lot of your supporters might be receiving
Liz Truss or Rachel Reeves's record on the economy. But Nigel and I are clear. It's very important that we instill in the public trust that we will take care of their money.
Are you
Thatcherites? I don't believe that you should just cosplay as Margaret Thatcher. Look, I admire Margaret Thatcher, what she did to turn around the country. In many respects, she inherited a country in a similar situation to the one that a reform government is likely to. But the solutions today, and certainly when the next election comes, will be very different to those of the 1970s and 80s. The solutions that we see are, yes, fiscal responsibility, sound money, managing the public finances properly, welfare reform to get the millions of people who are currently on benefits into the workplace and enjoying the dignity of work, a totally different energy policy to the one that the country has had in recent years,
I suppose,
where we go for cheap and reliable energy.
But the interesting
to make
thing
us competitive
on the benefits is that there will be people thinking of voting for you who are also benefiting from those benefits. You think today what's very much in the news is special educational needs, isn't it? Richard Tice, your colleague, saying that some parents gamed the system. Do you have the same commitment to the kind of expenditure on something like SEND that previous governments have, and that this government is now grappling with trying to reduce that expenditure but may well not manage?
Look, a reform government is going to look after the vulnerable. It's going to take care of those people who are decent, hardworking people but who are in tough times. It's obviously going to look after children who've got special educational needs. You know, I'm a parent myself. I visit schools all the time as a constituent CMP. I want to help to protect those children and their families. But we cannot allow the current welfare bill to keep on ballooning because, frankly, it's going to bankrupt the country. And so we have to bear down on it as a matter of basic fairness for taxpayers and to put the public finances on a sustainable footing. And that means changing, for example, the eligibility for some of our benefits.
Okay,
you know, if you look at, say, mild conditions like anxiety and depression, it can't be right that those are eligible for benefits or for motability cars. That's not fair to hard-working
Just in
Brits.
One word, until recently you remember the Conservative Party, yes or no, is it conceivable that there is a pact between Reform and the Conservatives after the next election, not before it, after it?
I don't think so, no. The trust is gone with the Conservative Party. That's why if you want a centre-right government after the next election, you have to do what I did, put party loyalty to one side and rally behind Nigel Farage and Reform.
Robert Jenrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the latest on the weather. Simon King's here.
Emma, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. Across England and Wales, we had a mixture of rain, sleet and snow overnight. Now, most of the snow fell over higher ground, causing some problems to the Trans-Pennine routes, for example, and the higher roads. But down to low levels, you may just have a bit of an icy, slushy covering of maybe 1 or 2 centimetres of snow, not causing too many problems. But that mixture of rain, sleet and snow is continuing to ease away. So for much of England and Wales, as we go into the afternoon, it's looking drier, albeit staying fairly cloudy across most areas, maybe a few spots of drizzle continuing around eastern areas of England. And for Wales and southwest England, we might see the cloud breaking up enough to bring us a few brighter spells, maximum temperatures getting up to about 4 to 10 degrees Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, it's pretty overcast and a bit damp this morning, but we will see another weather front moving from the west this afternoon, so that will bring a spell of rain, highs of 6 to 8 degrees here. And across Scotland, we've got some rain in northern and western areas of Scotland today, but further south and east it will be drier, although it will again be fairly cloudy, overcast skies with highs of 3 to 6 degrees Celsius. As we go through tonight and into tomorrow, we start to see a switch in wind direction to a southwesterly. Milder air will slowly spread its way in, but with it will come a band of rain as we go through into Friday, moving eastward across the UK, but temperatures 9 to 12 degrees.
Simon, thank you. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 19th of February. Good morning if you're just joining us or waking up. The headlines. Children in England with special educational needs face having their support reassessed when they go into secondary school. That's under leaked government proposals. We'll hear from a parent and a teaching union after the news and also reflect on potential political rebellion, should that go ahead. The family of a British couple detained in Iran says they've been sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage, which they deny. And the Prime Minister has just insisted that no one is above the law when asked on BBC Breakfast about Andrew Mountbatten's Windsor links with Jeffrey Epstein.
Also coming up in this hour, the former Prime Minister, now advisor to Microsoft, Rishi Sunak on AI. Not a threat, he says, but a promise of better things to come. And a week of special programmes has been announced to mark Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday, including a behind the scenes of this special moment in 1979.
There is more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know.
We talked to the conservationist who introduced Sir David to the gorillas for his landmark series Life on Earth. The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. They would lead to the system being completely redesigned, with implications for many of the 480,000 pupils who have legally binding education, health and care plans. Under the changes, children would have their plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school, something which could risk a political backlash. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
Many parents seek to get an education, health and care plan in place before the end of primary school for children with special educational needs. It confers legal rights to individual support. Under these reforms, the child would no longer automatically keep the EHCP as they go up to secondary school. Children with the most complex needs are more likely to retain an EHCP. But any cut in the number of those with legally binding plans will be hugely politically controversial. I understand to offset this, all children with special educational needs, including those currently without an EHCP, will get what's called an individual support plan. This will be assessed by the school and come with some legal status. Ministers are likely to argue this will lead to more support at an earlier stage, without families needing to battle with the system.
Gary Aubin is the co-author of The Parent's Guide to SEND. He told us it makes more sense to reassess pupils after they've completed a year of secondary school, not before.
You know that when that child gets from year 6 to year 7, if there's any threat of support being reduced, that's going to make that whole process worse for everyone. I don't understand why it wouldn't be better to go, actually, the child's going to transition from one key stage to the next, for example, do one full year of secondary school, and that's the sort of, you know, big point at which we ask questions.
The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year while on a motorcycle trip around the world and are currently being held in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Craig and Lindsay Foreman were travelling through Iran on their motorcycles when they were arrested. They've now been held for more than 12 months, often in solitary confinement and incommunicado. At brief court hearings, most recently last October, the couple from East Sussex were accused of espionage, which they deny. The family say no evidence has been presented, nor any opportunity for defence given. They've now been informed the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Their son, Joe Bennett, said he was deeply concerned for their welfare. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said the sentence was completely appalling and totally unjustifiable and promised to pursue the case relentlessly.
The couple's son, Joe Bennett, told us the news was gut-wrenching, but that the family remained hopeful.
I mean, it's tough, isn't it, right? Because you don't fully ever know. But I think if you look at history, the 10 years is just a number, and that we work towards it being as short a time as possible. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's an absolutely mental thing to be discussing with your innocent mother and stepfather that they are facing 10 years in an Iranian prison.
The Prime Minister has told BBC Breakfast that he thinks Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor should testify to the US Congress about the information released in the Epstein files. The former Prince Andrew has consistently denied any wrongdoing. Sir Keir Starmer said anyone who had relevant information should come forward, but he declined to say whether Andrew should volunteer himself to the police.
That's a matter for the police. They will conduct their own investigations. But one of the core principles in our system is that everybody is equal under the law and nobody is above the law. And it is really important that that is applied across the board.
Tech platforms will have to remove intimate images which have been shared without consent within 48 hours under government proposals. Ministers say that those which fail to comply would face a fine of up to 10% of their global revenue or even having their services blocked in the UK. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Revenge porn is the sharing of intimate images without a person's consent. That is already illegal. Now, the government wants to compel social media companies to remove such pictures and videos within 48 hours once they've been reported. The plans also mean that victims would only have to flag an image once, rather than contacting different platforms separately and waiting for them to respond individually. The Prime Minister told BBC Breakfast the images should be treated with the same severity as terrorist material. The proposals need the approval of the regulator, Ofcom, but officials are confident the new powers will be in force by the summer. It comes after Sir Keir Starmer's clash with the owner of X, Elon Musk, over his AI tool, Grok, creating fake nude images of women and girls. But the Conservatives said for all his tough rhetoric, the Prime Minister had arrived late to this issue, and the new measures are unlikely to quell those calling for tougher restrictions and a ban on social media for under-16s.
President Trump has urged the Prime Minister not to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, saying the joint British-American military base may be needed to launch attacks on Iran. A year ago, Mr. Trump told Sir Keir that he was inclined to go along with the UK's agreement, before branding it an act of great stupidity last month. Then, 2 weeks ago, the US President said the deal was the best Sir Keir could make. In his post last night, the US president condemned the plan and insisted the UK should remain strong in the face of wokeism. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth reports.
On Tuesday, the US State Department expressed its support for the Chagos deal, which would see the UK hand the islands to Mauritius and lease back a joint British-American military base on Diego Garcia for 99 years. But last night, President Trump wrote on social media that Sir Keir Starmer was making a big mistake, adding, "Do not give away Diego Garcia," in capital letters. It's not clear what prompted the latest shift in position. It's understood the matter wasn't raised in a phone call between Mr. Trump and Sir Keir on Tuesday night. In response, the Foreign Office said the deal to secure the military base on Diego Garcia was crucial to the security of the UK and its allies, and the only way to guarantee the long-term future of the base.
The former president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has been found guilty of insurrection and given a life sentence after he attempted to impose martial law in 2024. The politician's declaration triggered street protests and was abandoned. Mr. Yoon was later impeached and removed from office. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jake Kwon, reports.
The former president had argued that his martial law attempt was a benign gesture which was attempting to draw attention to what he claimed was the wrongdoing of the opposition party. The judge said Yoon had caused fundamental damage to South Korea's democracy and deserved a harsh punishment. Yoon is likely to appeal and the case could end up at the Supreme Court. Thousands of his supporters gather outside the courthouse for the verdict. The judge had said Yoon's martial law order has left the country deeply divided.
The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, says a BBC investigation exposing grooming gangs in London shows that professionals such as police officers and social workers are failing to protect girls from harm. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
Our investigation revealed two types of grooming gangs in the capital. One where men use girls primarily for sex, and another where men forced victims to sell drugs and as part of that sleep with dozens of men. The Children's Commissioner said the cases indicate that even the professionals charged with protecting these girls, the police, social workers and health agencies, are not always responding to them as victims of crime. She said the reporting showed that girls were being abused and ignored today. The Metropolitan Police says it's trained 23,000 officers in combating child exploitation.
The Met Office is expected to confirm this morning that the village of Cardinham in mid-Cornwall has now seen 50 consecutive days of rain. It's the latest evidence of the soggy start to the year after Northern Ireland had its wettest January in 149 years. Laura Pratt in Cardinham says the weather has caused quite the trouble in their home.
My house has never been more full of wet, sopping wet clothes. You have a dog and two young children and it's half term. Just got to go out, get out there and do it. But yeah, and my husband's a roofer, so it's not been ideal for him either. But, you know, here we are.
Laura Pratt in soggy Cardinham.
Jane, thank you. It's 10 minutes past 8. We've been hearing in the news bulletins that the details of what the government is proposing for the future of special educational needs and disabilities education, otherwise known as SEND, have been leaked. So we're getting a sense of what's on the table, and that could potentially lead to another Labour rebellion and some upset amongst already frustrated parents. Chief amongst the shake-up, in terms of what we know already of these plans, or what we're finally learning, rather, which would be this shake-up the biggest in a generation, would be that pupils in England with less complex and serious needs, including many of who have had autism and ADHD diagnosed, and I should say that's how it's been described, will no longer be deemed eligible for education, health and care plans, EHCPs as they're known. And from 2029, those with an existing EHCP will have their needs assessed under the new system at the end of primary before secondary school. There'll be other plans, of course, too. There's been a huge consultation on this, the government is at pains to stress. Will this be better? And for whom? The children? The families? How will it affect teachers? Let's try to get into a bit of this now, and certainly by also understanding the scale of how much we spend on this and how the investment is or isn't being made as good as it could, if I could put it like that. Luke Sabatier is Research Fellow at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Luke, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you lay out for us the scale of this and how big a, you know, spend area this is and what's going on with it?
So the changes of the last 10 years have actually been really profound. So spending on special educational needs has almost doubled over the last 10 years by about £8 billion. The numbers of children with education, health and care plans has almost doubled. So we've seen an incredibly rapid transformation in the numbers and in spending. Whilst at the same time, despite spending about £8 billion more on special educational needs, we see huge amounts of parental conflict, school stress, councils under stress, and quality is incredibly patchy. So the real challenge is developing a system that can keep spending and costs under control, but can also provide high quality support to children when they actually need it.
I mean, I know this is a leak at this stage and more details are expected to be announced formally next week, but, you know, and you've been looking at the numbers, but, you know, is there a sense of how you can do this for less?
I think there is a sense of how you can do this for less. And there's a sense that you could provide better support at a lower cost. So at the moment, EHCPs are very much a binary system. They're 1-0 and they lead to really high cost forms of support that might not be appropriate for all children. There will be some children that need a specialist educational place at a very high cost, and those things will need to be there. There are children that will need 2 years of speech and language therapy just to help them catch up at age 4 and age 5. There's a huge, vast range of different types of needs. So having a system that is more flexible to those needs and can put that support in place earlier would be a very good change.
Luke Sabatier, Research Fellow at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, thank you. Let me welcome Hayley Harding, parents of two boys with EHCP, with pet plans, as I've just been explaining, who also runs Let Us Learn To, that campaign, that's the name of it. Hayley, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. You've just been hearing from Luke there is a way of doing this at a lower cost that works better. From what you've heard of the plans so far, the white paper, the leaked details, are you encouraged?
I don't know. I think we need more detail. And I think, like any parent, as I've spoken about many times before, I've got a child who is in mainstream right now with a lot of support. So that is a worry, even for me, even though I'm obviously involved with the changes in the SEND development group right now. I'm concerned that those children, particularly of the higher needs and the SEND betweeners, won't get the support they need. The only thing I would say, and if it's any reassurance to parents right now, there has been no talk of the fact that certain conditions won't get EHCPs. It's everything that is being spoken about is very much based on the needs and addressing the needs, not the labels, effectively.
Yes, although what I was talking about there is that there might be a change in that way, that those who have been eligible may not be eligible.
I would hope not. That's all I could say, because obviously I've got two children that are in that bracket, and I cannot see how they would be able to continue at school without support.
It might not be that, though. So, yeah. Forgive me, and I know we're both flying a bit blind here, but it might not be without support. It might be that the way that support is funded and offered changes.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we've acknowledged that due to inflation, for example, the way that the system we currently got structured was that since 2014, if £6,000 worth of support can be justified for a child, and then they need more, then they have to go for a plan. You have to seek a plan. But obviously, that was a very different level of support back in 2014 than it is now. So we have a lot of children who are having to get plans that were never originally thought about. So I think if there's a way that the government can do this that gets them that help without the bureaucracy, without having to go through this long process, then that would actually be really welcomed by parents, because too many right now are not getting that because so much support is being given to the ones with AHCPs. It's a system that really desperately needs to be reversed.
How frustrating is it, Hayley, at the moment, with how it works?
Enormously frustrating. I have to say, I've literally... So parents just last Friday were told whether or not their children would get the schools that they need. I'm in that position now of being told there isn't a school for my child, even though he needs one.
Really?
It never ends. Yeah, yeah. The availability isn't there, and the communication isn't there. It's an endless battle for parents, and it really needs to stop because we've got so much going on at home. The last thing we need right now is to have to battle for them to go to school as well. Like, it's enough that we've got already.
Hayley Harding, thank you for talking to us. Stay with me here, stay with us all, because Pepe Diazio, the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, is also on the line reacting to this leak. Pepe, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Do you like the sound of what you're hearing already?
I have to say that I think it seems very promising. What you've heard there from Hayley is an example of frustrated parents who have had to fight to get whatever they need to support their children. You've got professionals who I represent who have had their hands tied because they haven't got access to the funds as early as possible that they'd like. And you've heard from Luke that says that actually we've got a system that there are literally billions of pounds going into, whether it be in terms of transport, whether it be in terms of tribunals or increased bureaucracy, when actually we need to be getting this to the very young people that need it most, to make sure that we provide them with the intervention and the specialist support that they need in their local school, ideally, and where that's not appropriate or possible, that we ensure that we've got special schools that can do that. So I don't see this as something that we should fear. It's what we're seeing is actually something which is essentially over a decade of underinvestment and a system that has been taking money into the wrong places, into the wrong hands, and making sure really that we are realigning this to allow young people to be at a school that's nearby with them, with people that they grew up with on the same streets have, but enable that school to provide them with the support that they need.
The reassessment at different school stages, what do you make of that?
Well, at the moment, that's tied up in an awful lot of bureaucracy in EACPs. So whilst the EACPs provide a plan, they also take an infinite amount of time and involve a number of professionals, which head teachers often then have to wait in order to get the funding to provide the support for that young people that is widely acknowledged that they need. And parents get very frustrated at that moment. And what head teachers would say to you is, if we had access to that money straight away and we had the people in the school with the specialist skills, we'd be giving that support upstream. We'd be getting that intervention, that support to the young people straight away. And we could take out the whole tier that it is somehow increasing the billions that are going into a system that is absolutely broken right now.
The Times has got the detail that it will be for schools themselves to take, you've reflected a bit of this, but to take the entire cost of meeting a pupil's SEND needs without extra government funding. The government has announced £200 million to help train staff in SEND. Is that realistic?
I think it's a start. It's a first step. I think that teachers on this, listening to this, will think, well, what sort of support am I going to get? What training am I going to get? And we need to make sure that we reassure them and get the right training in the right place to ensure that they're equipped with the right tools. And then schools more broadly need to be able to have access to those specialist skills that are necessary, whether it be speech and language therapists, educational psychologists, or people that can come together to support young people, better identify their needs and better support them more appropriately on the ground in their mainstream school. This is the future, I think, and certainly something that parents will think, if I can get access to the support that's so needed so quickly, that'll take out the frustration that they're feeling right now. And head teachers will think, well, just give me the resources with which I can actually support these young people. And at the heart of all this, you've got the state hopefully taking control of something in a better way that will mean that young people are better supported and can thrive in the schools that are in their local community.
Thank you very much to Pepe Diazio, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. And you were listening to Hayley Harding there, who's a parent dealing with this, but also running the campaign Let Us Learn Too. It's hugely difficult and an area that parents feel incredibly passionate about. Of course they do. A government spokesperson said it will be setting out its full plan shortly that will end the one-size-fits-all school system that has held too many children back. And for more analysis and reaction, join Women's Hour at 10 o'clock. And also you could check out their new podcast, Send in the Spotlight, which is dedicated to special educational needs and disabilities. You can just search for Send in the Spotlight on BBC Sounds.
21 minutes past eight is the time. The Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan writes about AI like this. "We are people on a beach," she says. "There is a tsunami coming. We can see it. It's huge. We can't stop it. Should we run? Which way? We're being told that AI will make us rich, but also that it may kill us. Agentic AI makes its own decisions, or at least takes its own actions." Daria Modai, the CEO of Anthropic, one of the very big players, writes in a blog the following sentence: "AI will be capable of a very wide range of human cognitive abilities, perhaps all of them. There is a possibility of terrible empowerment," he says, and he is often thought of as an optimist. So, what can we do? Where do we fit in? What do the governments do that we elect? There is a huge AI summit taking place in Delhi today, and among those there is Rishi Sunak, the former Prime Minister, current Conservative MP for Richmond and Northallerton, and senior advisor for Microsoft and Anthropic as well. So we began with the good that AI can do.
It is right to focus on the positives, and I do believe that AI can become, I think what I would say, is one of the most powerful democratizing and uplifting forces that we've ever seen. And specifically, I think that's because it can expand and equalize access to healthcare and education. And ultimately, those are the services that we all need to live better and more fulfilling lives. That's especially true in lots of parts of the world where that isn't the case today. And to me, I think that's how we, what I would say, raise the floor for humanity through this technology. It's through democratizing access to healthcare and education in those parts of the world which they don't have that.
Yeah, so someone at the moment who doesn't have much access to either of those things, suddenly via AI, via a tablet or a phone or whatever, is able to get that delivered to them.
That's exactly right. I mean, in education, what you're seeing is AI is able to deliver very personalized tutoring and teaching to students across India and Africa at very low cost. It's been shown to double their rate of learning. It doesn't require this a super fast broadband connection or a fancy laptop. It can be done on a very simple device. And that's been built using, I think almost now it's like a billion different interactions of students with questions, but that's been developed into a personalized AI model. So that's one very powerful example. Similarly, in healthcare, I think maternal health, the health of mothers who are giving birth, is something that we need to focus on, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And again, something there that has been developed in Kenya that works on mums-to-be's phones has proved to be really excellent at identifying any issues, getting those mums the healthcare they need. And those are just a couple of the things that are happening today that are already making a difference, as I said, and helping, I think, to raise the floor for humanity through this technology.
On the other hand, the boss of one of the companies you're involved with, Anthropic, has recently said, "This is the trap. AI is so powerful, such a glittering prize. It is very difficult for human civilization to impose any restraints on it at all," and a safety researcher quit Anthropic, saying the world is in peril.
I absolutely understand people's anxieties and concerns about this. And this is why when I hosted the first of these AI summits a few years ago as Prime Minister, I made the focus safety. And I thought that it was important that we kicked off this summit series with that as a topic, because this is obviously an incredible technology, as we've discussed, that can do an enormous amount of good, but it also brings with it new risks, risks that those who are developing the technology were open with me about at the time and have continued to be so. And I always thought that we needed to take these issues seriously and give people the confidence that their governments have got a grip of this.
But they haven't, have they?
Well, I think ultimately my view was the public wouldn't give permission almost for the technology to be developed and used if they didn't believe that it was safe. And to answer your question directly, one of the things coming out of that first summit that we held at Bletchley Park was the creation of AI Security Institute in the UK, which has now been mimicked around the world. And these security institutes are doing excellent work, and particularly our UK one, where the team are globally recognised for being the best in the business. And what they do is they look at the models before they're released. And this was one of the commitments that we achieved at that first summit. So the model, the companies that are developing the models work with our security institute to get them to test the models, because my view is companies shouldn't be marking their own homework. That's a job of democratic institutions. And this security institute has the technical capability and can move at the speed that's required in order to evaluate the models. And where they identify any flaws or issues, they work with the companies to remedy those. And so far, that has proved to be a very effective way to deal with some of these risks. And it's one in which the UK is leading on, thanks to the initiatives that we took a few years ago.
Why then does a safety researcher at Anthropic, whose name is Mrinank Sharma, tell the world that it is in peril, as he puts it? And it's not just from AI or bioweapons, from a whole series of interconnected crises unfolding at this very moment. He says he's repeatedly seen, this is from within, how hard it is to truly let our values govern our actions. And this is within a company. And I suppose the challenge is that it is naive to think that governments or peoples are in charge of all this when the companies are themselves changing at such breakneck pace and indeed using AI to change themselves.
I don't think we can be complacent about the risks. I'm excited about the opportunities, but of course, with every technology, there comes risks. And you're absolutely right that it's a responsibility of governments to make sure that they can keep their citizens safe. And more importantly, just give them the confidence in the first instance that this technology will be safe. And that's why I go back to the AI Security Institute. That's exactly the type of body that can do that evaluative work and make sure we're abreast of these risks as they develop. And look, lots of people will have different views on this. My view was that was the right approach to take. I don't think we can kind of pretend that this is not happening or think that we can just unilaterally stop it from happening. That would be misguided and wrong. But what we can do is invest in the capability to evaluate the risks, work with the companies to fix them as they arise. And that's so far what we have been doing. And again, I think discussions here at this summit just reinforce to me how the UK's role in that is appreciated by many people around the world.
Rishi Sunak, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And now, Misha Glennie to tell us about In Our Time, coming up in around half an hour.
Good morning. If he'd followed the advice of his worst critics, John Keats would have given up poetry and gone back to his day job. Instead, he gave the best response possible, a year of brilliant lasting poems, odes to a Grecian urn and a nightingale among them. This extraordinary outburst of creativity ended only when he began to succumb to the tuberculosis that would kill him in Rome at the age of 25, still virtually unknown to the wider public. Yet how his reputation grew. That's John Keats with Fiona Stafford, Nicholas Rowe and Maker O'Halloran on In Our Time on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Truth is beauty, and beauty is the Today programme on a Thursday morning. So back to Justin in the studio.
Beauty. Misha, thank you for that.
Beautiful, Justin.
Beauty will also be the sport. We haven't lost it. We've just delayed it slightly. So I can tell you the weather instead. Southern area is going to see any rain and snow ease through the morning, leaving a mostly dry and dull day.
I think you're nearly blushing there. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 29 minutes past 8, and now a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
Special educational needs support for children in England is facing its biggest shake-up in a generation under leaked government proposals. Under the changes, children would have their education, health and care plans reassessed when they move from primary to secondary school. The Department for Education is expected to outline its full measures next week, but said it would create a better system for all families. Pepe Diazio, the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, told this programme that he believed the plans would realign what he called a broken system that had suffered over a decade of underinvestment. The family of two Britons detained in Iran say the couple have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of espionage, which they deny. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested in January last year and are currently being held in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. The former president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has been found guilty of insurrection and given a life sentence after he attempted to impose martial law in 2024. The politician's declaration triggered street protests and was abandoned. Mr. Yoon was later impeached and removed from office.
Thanks, Jane. And now Daleth Lloyd's here with the sport.
Emma, thank you. Good morning again. Treble winners Hull Kingston Rovers can be crowned the best rugby league club in the world tonight when they take on NRL champions Brisbane Broncos in the World Club Challenge. The Robins won the Challenge Cup, League Leaders Shield and Super League last season, just 9 years after they were relegated from England's top flight. I've been along to Hull KR to find out the secret to their success.
Done a job on the reigning champions tonight. Oh!
After the siren, it was probably when Joe Burgess took that intercept in the grand final, because then I realised that we'd done something really special, which was win all three. So that was probably the moment that was just like, wow, we've just done something incredibly special here, you know. So when you break it down, there's a lot of moments throughout the year that was special, but yeah, him taking that intercept, that's what made me feel like, wow, well, these players and staff have done something really special.
I've come to Craven Park, the home of Hull Kingston Rovers, as the club prepare to make more history by taking on Australia's NRL champions, Brisbane Broncos. I'm in the offices inside the stadium. Let me just give the Chief Executive Officer's Paul Lakin's door a knock, see if he's in. Paul, hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. You?
Yeah, very good. Thanks for allowing us to come and have a chat in your office. You've got some wonderful pictures. Just quickly describe these pictures that are on the wall. It's all of Hull's success, isn't it?
It is in the last year or so, yeah. So the large one that you're seeing there is the opening part of the semi-final leading to the grand final last year with a firework display. And then just over across on this wall here, this is last year when we won the Challenge Cup final, our first trophy for over 40 years. Incredibly proud moment for ourselves, and I think that was the catalyst that gave us the confidence to kick on and win the trophies at the end of the year.
So how do you do it, Paul? Because it's all well and good having a strategy to try and turn a club around and have ideas, but how do you actually go about it?
I genuinely believe this. I think to move forward with positive momentum, you need the club to be totally in sync on and off the pitch. And then the real sort of golden element of it is if the players are in touch with the community, the fan base, and the fan base are in touch with the players, because then it becomes powerful. And I think a pivotal moment for us was when we appointed Willie Peters 3 years ago.
Hi, I'm Willie Peters, head coach of Hull Kingston Rovers.
Could have you ever envisaged when you came here 3 years ago the amount that you've achieved with this club?
Well, I think you hope and you plan and you've got a vision. And that's what we've certainly have had.
I'm Elliot Minchella from Hull Kingston Rovers, and I play loose forward.
What's it been like in the city of Hull in the last few months, and particularly in the aftermath during the celebrations in October?
A real joy. Everybody's just so pleased to even see you, and everybody wants to shake your hand or you say congratulations and tell you where they was when we won the Super League. Or, you know, everybody's got their own story, which I think is really special.
Well, Hull Kingston Rovers is, of course, in the east part of the city, and I've made my way along Holderness Road, a busy road in the east part, and a huge part of the community where you'll find many Hull KR fans. I've made my way into a little pub, and I've got the proprietors here. Tell me your names.
John.
And?
Jamie.
What's the name of this pub?
The Crooked Billet.
I love that name.
You're both big Hull KR fans.
We are indeed, yeah.
Looking forward to facing Brisbane Broncos for the World Club Challenge. I mean, what a match that's going to be.
I can't wait. We played Queensland back in the 80s. I think it's the first time I've played an Australian team since then. And obviously, we're champions and they're champions. So it's a clash of the champions.
And Jamie, I've come into this pub a little bit quieter today. There's still quite a few people around. What is it like when Hull Kingston Rovers play a match here?
It's really busy. The atmosphere is buzzing. Everyone just gets excited. They come before a match or they come to watch the match here. Yeah, it's a real good place to be.
Have you seen any of the players come in here before?
Yep, Mikey Lewis was in here a couple of weeks ago, having a pint of Guinness.
So Mikey Lewis grew up watching his fierce rivals from FC. Could he be the Hull KR hero? Yes, he can! Years of hurt in the Challenge Cup! 40 years of hurt as a team! Hull KR have won the Challenge Cup in 2025!
What would it mean to win the Club World Challenge?
Look, I mean, a lot. Like, every piece of silverware that we've won last year meant to us. And why is it the most important? Because it's the next piece of silverware available. You know, we always talk about, no matter what, you know, silverware is available, we're going after it.
That's the goal. We want to win. It's a cup final and we want to go and chase another trophy. So that's the aim for the club.
It's the pinnacle. The absolute pinnacle.
What a moment it could be for Hull Kingston Rovers. There's commentary of the World Club Challenge on BBC Sounds. You can also watch it live on BBC Three.
Della, thank you for that. 24 minutes to nine is the time. London has a problem with grooming gangs abusing young girls. The mayor, Sadiq Khan, has long suggested that this is not necessarily the case. The mayor said the situation in the capital was different to other parts of the country. Young people were being groomed for county lines, drugs gangs, but he was unwilling always to talk about grooming gangs in the same way that we talk about them in other parts of the country. But those gangs do exist, according to a BBC investigation. Millie, not her real name, spoke to the BBC's Seema Kotecha about her experience of grooming gangs in London. She said they did not involve selling drugs. They mirrored what happened in towns and cities like Rotherham, Rochdale, Oldham. She was 15 years old.
They'd essentially, they'd just give us drink, give us drugs. Next thing I know, I'd just be in the bedroom with one of them. Then I'd come out, could be another one. After that, it could be another one. Sometimes it was only one, sometimes it could be three. And then we'd just leave, really. Back then, I didn't even think of it, though. I just thought I was having a fun time and getting away from my family home. And essentially, I definitely wasn't. Thinking back at it now, it's like a horror story. Like, when I think back and think about what I actually went through. It's going on everywhere and it has been for years, and even before it happened to me, it's been going on for years and years. So why would it suddenly just stop? Like, it wouldn't. There's so many people that think they're getting away with it, so why wouldn't they carry on?
That was Millie. Kelly, also not a real name, said she'd been groomed by three white men in the capital. She was initially forced to deal drugs, but said exploitation then got worse. Her voice, her words have been voiced by a producer.
I had no money, felt neglected, and saw an opportunity to feel part of something. So I made some bad connections, and before long I was selling drugs on the streets. But that turned into having sex to keep people on side if we owed them, or as an enticement for them to buy drugs off me and the gang. I didn't feel like I was groomed or exploited. I didn't think I was a victim. It's taken me a while to realise I was used and manipulated. It gave my life purpose for a bit, and I felt needed. I didn't feel that at home. I was looking for something because I was lonely and bored.
Let us talk first to Dal Babu, former Metropolitan Police Chief, who's superintendent, now member of the London Police Board, which does have oversight of the Met. Morning to you.
Good morning.
I suppose what we're saying this morning is that Sadiq Khan ought to be aware that to some extent London does have the same problems as those other mainly northern cities, and that's an important first step.
Yeah, I think Sadiq Khan and Samart Rowley have both said that there is a complex picture of grooming. I think that what happened in the northern towns where men of Pakistani heritage had abused white working class girls was an absolute scandal. I think Certainly in my 30 years of policing, I have not seen that kind of behaviour on that scale. I think what we do have is county lines exploitation. It's where young women, girls, are right at the bottom of the rung. They are the ones that are sexually abused, as we've heard from those horrific reports from those survivors, from Seema Kotecha's report there. You see that those women are used as commodities to pay for drugs, to keep people at bay.
I suppose the issue is the extent to which you can separate out. So obviously there are gangs, and gangs abuse girls and have done for a long time, forever. There are these specific gangs. So, for instance, that girl we're calling Millie says, I don't remember their names, it sounds horrible, I just know they were Asian. I think she meant South Asian. Sometimes they just said, oh, you're a nice young white girl. In other words, that is very much the same thing that happened in those northern towns. And it's partly admitting that, never mind the other abuse going on, and there is, that the admitting of that is seen by some victims and the groups that support them as important.
Yeah, I mean, that's a testimony of a survivor, and we need to listen to that. And I don't think we should be at all concerned about making sure that we have the ethnicity of people when we have that information from survivors. I think Seema's report had talked to five survivors. Two had said that they were exploited by South Asian gangs, and three had said they'd been exploited by white black gangs. So I think what's really, really important, and we've seen this with Epstein, the common factor in all of this is men. Men will abuse and have been abusing young, vulnerable girls. And I think what we, Dame Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner, made a point around ensuring that we have better training, better understanding. And I think what we need to see is resources put into safeguarding, made sure that the police, children's services, voluntary sectors work more closely together in order to deal with this issue. So we should. This has become a very, very political issue now, and I think it becomes extremely difficult to have these conversations without some political ramifications. But I think we need to remember that the most important people in all of this are the survivors, and we need to be doing everything we can to protect those young, vulnerable women.
Dame Vera Baird is on the line, former Victims Commissioner for England and Wales, former Solicitor General as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you think Sadiq Khan needs to say more about specifically grooming gangs?
I mean, I appreciate that what he said before. When I was the Police and Crime Commissioner myself, which is the role in which I guess he's speaking, I only knew that there were grooming gangs in Newcastle area because the police kept me informed about that. He will not have said that there weren't any without consulting Commissioner Mark Rowley, and I think he started to go back on that. I'm not sure what more you think he should say. Are you talking about this level, this element of racism? I would have thought that was pretty well in the air.
I suppose the issue is when you say we have a particular problem, you open yourselves up then, you open yourself up and the place that you represent up to the kind of scrutiny that there is, for instance, on other places as well, and indeed the when it eventually gets off the ground, the inquiry that is going to take place.
Yes, well, I can't quite link that to what he said. I think, you know, there is no doubt that, as I think you've just heard from Dal, county lines gangs have historically, almost since we knew they existed, been responsible for abusing young women, not only to provide for the gang boys' own sexual wants, but also to be traded, also to carry weapons because they're less likely to be searched than a boy. And I think you've produced here, you know, fabulous piece of work by Seema, I must say, you know, an array of victims who unfortunately will have been treated, you know, probably at school, probably by social services, certainly by the police, as girls who've made a lifestyle choice to behave like this when they should have been being protected. Because the obvious vulnerability that the young woman you just had on expresses, you know, rather dull at school, breaking out into becoming an attractive young woman, knowing that there's an interesting world out there, and immediately being pulled into it by horribly unsavoury sources and landing her where she was, not even understanding that she had been trafficked, in effect, to other men to pay drugs debts. This is a pattern. You know, Louise Casey was very clear. There is a predominance of Pakistani men or South Asian men in grooming gangs. But there are spots here, aren't there, which are not Pakistani men. So we shouldn't just close our eyes entirely whilst acknowledging the ethnic component that obviously Louise Casey found existed.
Dame Vera Baird and Dal Babu as well. Thank you both.
It's 16 minutes to nine. Now, it became one of the biggest scandals in British medical history. Hundreds of women and men mutilated and maimed by the man who became known as the Butcher Surgeon. He was at large in the private sector and in the NHS, performing unnecessary and violent operations on mainly women, some of whom didn't even have the cancer he falsely diagnosed them with. I'm talking about Ian Paterson, who was finally sentenced to jail in 2017, initially for 15 years, then extended to 20, but is expected to walk free next year. He was found guilty of 17 counts of wounding with intent and three of unlawful wounding. One of the women key to bringing him down and having him jailed is Deborah Douglas, someone who Ian Paterson performed major surgery on, despite her never needing her breast removed or the intensive course of chemotherapy he prescribed. She's a victim-turned-campaigner and now fights for those women who never lived to see Paterson brought to justice, as well as those who have. I've been talking to her for my podcast, Ready to Talk, and she's pretty formidable. She told me how it felt to see Ian Paterson in the dock.
He was there, and it was Nottingham Crown Court, and any time I could get there, and particularly on the day he was first taking the stand, it was coming up to the Easter weekend, and I was told, just enjoy yourself. Why are you going to court? You know, it's bank holiday weekend. Have a relaxing time. But it's like, no, I can't. I've got to see him take the stand.
And what was he like? What was your impression of him now in this new light? You know, not the all-powerful doctor in a room with you.
So he was allowed in open court. He was allowed to walk around freely. On the morning of his sentence, for example, or on the morning of when they were giving the verdict, I should say, he was sat having his breakfast with his daughter in the same canteen as me and another victim. We could look directly at him, sitting over from us, quite happily eating his sausage sandwich or whatever he was eating for breakfast. No sign of nerves. And the first day he took the stand, when I walked in, he'd lost weight. So I looked at him, I sort of squinted, and I thought, it is him, yeah, he's lost weight, he's gone a bit greyer. But he looked over at me, and I was quite close to him. Nottingham Crown Court isn't a huge court. Our eyes met, and he smiled because he thought I was there to support him. The look on my face was, no. You know, he's arrogant. He's so arrogant. He didn't see himself as somebody that would be found guilty.
There is a verdict. And in 2017, it takes till then, Ian Paterson was found guilty, convicted of wounding patients through botched and unnecessary operations. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison.
Yeah.
What was that moment like?
Massive relief. I mean, there's pictures of me crying outside court because I tried to disappear because it was such a tiring time. And I mean, mentally exhausting. And they were reading those verdicts and I'm staring directly at him. His daughter sat next to him. She's crying. He is just shaking his head. What are they doing to me? What? I'm innocent, you know. Looked across to the police officers there. They were crying.
Really?
Yeah. They'd really fought, yeah. And also, you know, one of their own had died. One of their own was a Paterson patient.
Did it feel like justice?
No, not to me. Not to me. Because
seeing him be sentenced for 20
years? I mean, it was a relief. That was, we'll take that, you know.
I mean,
yeah. Yes, that's justice. He should be in jail. But it was, but why did he get away with it? How did he get away with it? Who knew what and when and where? You know, always in my head is those sort of questions.
Maria Caulfield at the time in the government said, and this is after the independent inquiry, which then followed. And these things take, you know, quite a long time, and I'm sort of moving forward with it. But, she said, the systems that should have protected patients failed.
Yeah.
And I suppose just taking a step back, I mean, as I mentioned, you've just written this book, The Cost of Trust.
Mm-hmm.
You're still a campaigner, aren't you?
Yeah.
Even though he's gone to prison, it's what led to and enabled and allowed that you still seem to have your eye on.
I absolutely do, because fought for the inquiry. Out of the inquiry, there's 15 recommendations. For some reason, the government split two of them into part one and two, and they refer to them as 17. But those recommendations are there to protect patients. And people are not aware. They think when they go into a private hospital, they're getting better treatment, still really don't know what's going on. But what they fail to realise is the consultant rents the room. He does not work for that private hospital. Therefore, if there's a criminal act, you are not covered by indemnity. The Medical Defence Union won't cover him. It's not necessarily that he has his own insurance. That still hasn't changed.
If Ian Paterson was to listen to this, what would you say to him?
At least apologise and mean it. He has never once apologised. He does not show any sign of contrition. He acts like it's Paterson. He's been wronged. He's on an open wing. He's doing an open university degree. And he will be out. He will walk next year because he's not seen as a risk. He's seen as somebody that, you know, he's a consultant at the end of the day. He's not going to go around harming people. That doesn't take into consideration his victims.
And yet he did. That was the formidable Deborah Douglas. You'll be able to hear her story in full on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your pods from tomorrow. You can look up and subscribe. That would be great too. Ready to Talk with me, Emma Barnett, to hear Deborah in full and other similarly powerful insights.
10 to 9 is the time. Not one show, not two, but three are being planned for Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday. According to the BBC, Ian Redmond is chairman of the Gorilla Organisation, introduced Sir David to the gorillas of Rwanda in his early series, Life on Earth. Sir David memorably sitting among them.
As I sit here, there's more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know.
Ian Redmond is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And yes, it is one of the great moments, isn't it?
Yes, and it's so... It just unfolded as it happened. I don't know how much preparation as to what he was going to say David had made, but without a script and with a small film crew sitting amongst the gorillas, came out with a very profound statement about human-gorilla perceptions and relations, which had always been mutual animosity and fear, mainly because gorillas saw humans as a deadly threat, and most humans who approached gorillas were trying to kill them. So
so how did you organise this rapprochement, as it were?
Well, we had the benefit of Diane Fossey, who at that point, this was... I'm just looking at my field notes from the time. Monday the 9th of January 1978 was when that particular bit of film was made. But Diane had been studying those gorillas since 1967, and I'd been her assistant for a little over a year at that point. So the gorillas knew me, and it's to some people extraordinary. Gorillas understand the concept of a friend of a friend. So if they trust you... And you're with a bunch of strangers, they'll look at you and they'll look at them and think, okay, they're together, that's fine. And that's why, at that point, that was the biggest group of strangers we'd brought into the study groups, because there was no gorilla tourism in those days. And in those few moments, David Attenborough changed the world's perception of gorillas through that famous bit of film.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? And with what longer-term impact?
That's a good point, because I think the impact was twofold. The public suddenly saw gorillas that they'd only seen in the kind of King Kong context as raging monsters, as friendly family animals who would even be friendly to a visitor. And that changed public perception. But behind the scenes, this filming took place literally 10 days after one of our study group, a young silverback called Digit, whose portrait is behind me in my office. Digit had been killed by poachers. So the BBC crew, John Sparks, Dickie Bird, Martin Saunders and David Attenborough arrived in a very dramatic time when there was poaching, there was grief, and then they made this lovely programme, clip, short sequence in a programme. And behind the scenes, David had promised Diane that when he got back to London, he would try and rally support for her fight against the poachers. And out of that conversation he had with what was then the Fauna Preservation Society, now Fauna and Flora International, and other conservation groups, the Mountain Gorilla Project, the Mountain Gorilla Tourism, the better protection, so that today, every year, there are slightly more mountain gorillas than there were the year before.
Yeah. I mean, my goodness, it is a contribution worth celebrating, isn't it? I was saying three programmes, and this obviously, this that clip is somehow the granddaddy of all of it, but there's so much more as well.
Yes, well, the death of Digit changed the tenor of work at the research centre, and we focused more on conservation. And Diane set up the Digit Fund, and the guerrilla organisation, of which I'm the chairman, is a direct descendant of the Digit Fund in the UK. And in the US, it's the Diane Fossey Guerrilla Fund International. And we work with the Rwandan authorities and the Congolese and the Ugandan authorities to protect those guerrillas and ensure their future. And right now, they have a very positive future, as long as climate change doesn't dry up the rainfall that keeps the forests as rainforests. But that's a bigger picture. On the ground, thanks to Life on Earth and all the subsequent documentaries and articles, the mountain gorillas are in a much better place.
Ian Redman, the man who introduced Sir David Attenborough to the gorillas. Thank you very much. And that brings us to 5 to 9. And a word about something coming up. So why do politicians, what do politicians really mean when they say they're being transparent? Well, they just mean that, don't they? Oh, maybe not. Amanda Iannucci and guests unpack that expression on Radio 4 this morning. It's in Strong Message here, coming up at 9:45.
But now, at 9:05, we can tell you Game of Thrones takes to the stage. The Royal Shakespeare Company has announced the world premiere of Game of Thrones, The Mad King, a new play based on the novels by George R.R. Martin. The play is a prequel set over a decade before the events of Game of Thrones. George R.R. Martin is the exec producer of the show, which is going to be made in collaboration with HBO. They have the rights, I'm sure, to Game of Thrones, is possibly why. But we can talk now to the director, Dominic Cook. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I have confessed to you that I might need a little help here. I am not in the camp of Game of Thrones. Are you?
I am, yeah. But I've discovered through working on this show that the world is divided into two camps. The ones who know everything and are really into it, and the ones who know nothing. There's no grey area.
As one of our producers said this morning, you know, those who know, they probably have names for their swords.
Exactly. But we're trying to make a piece of theatre that will speak to both. So we've really dug into the backstory and gone into great detail, and we're answering questions that fans will want to have answers to. But we also want to make something for people who are going because they're interested in theatre or because they're partners of fans, like yourself.
Yes.
And it'll stand up for those people. That's the end. As a Game of Thrones widow.
But the detail, what can you say? You've not created it yet, or it is created?
No,
where are we up to?
So we haven't started rehearsals, but we have actually been working on it for 8 years.
Oh, just a casual 8 years, Dominic.
Not full-time, but it is immense, you know, because George R. R. Martin has imagined thousands of years of history. And so we had to get into this chunk of history and really work out what elements of it we were going to sort of focus on. But it starts at, if you imagine the Olympic Games of Westeros, it's a sort of gathering, it's a tournament of all the key players, mm-hmm. which becomes a sort of nest of intrigue and political plotting. And the man who is king at the beginning of the TV series, Robert Baratheon, it's sort of about how he becomes king.
And how he gets that. Yeah. So it's a slight sort of origin story to
exactly.
that. And the link to Shakespeare, what do you think that is?
Well, When I first sort of took this on, I just think you've got to be very careful when you're taking on a bit of IP that's known in another form, in this case TV and novels, and you have to find a theatrical form for it if you're putting it on stage. It has to live as a piece of theatre. And I discovered very early on that the original book of Song of Ice and Fire, which was his first book, George's first book, was based on the history plays, the Shakespeare history plays.
Ah.
So we started thinking, well, maybe that's the form here. That's the way to do this, because it's all the same stuff. It's dynastic struggle. It's generational conflict in powerful families. It's got a very beady eye on the nature of political power, the sort of corrosive nature of political power, just as Shakespeare's plays do. So we sort of use that form to shape the material.
Why are we obsessed with families and difficult families, do you think, and powers? I mean, it's obvious in some ways because of what we're from and what we think about, but that witnessing of it, do you think?
In terms of Shakespeare or
yes,
drama?
Yes, or when you, you know, as a sort of inspiration for stories in the first place.
Well, I think that because we are hardwired to be part of families, we have these sort of like unconscious pulls towards one another in families, and they're often in conflict with who we are as individuals and our desire, you know, to make our own mark. So I've always thought that every family is like a country, like
really?
An individual country, yeah. Because when you get to know new families through a sort of friend or acquaintance or whatever, you discover they have codes and ways of being.
Are you the chief
unique.
Creative officer in your family, or what was it if you were to give political
roles?
That's
a really complicated question. But I think I can't really answer that. There's a lot of creative people around. Yeah.
In the cabinet of Dominic Cook's family. I love that though. Look, families are like countries and that whole dynastic thing. Well, good luck. 8 years in the making. And it's out when?
We open in... Well, actually, I don't think we're completely settled on dates. It's in the summer. We're